It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, streaming live from Badminton in Gloucestershire on the talkradio.org.uk stream, Friday the 12th of May. Well, it's not quite 5 o'clock, is it? Sorry, 11 minutes past five. So I'm sure our sound engineer Dave won't mind if we run a little bit over 8 o'clock. So we're live at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything but Google. So that's your plug and your counter plug there. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military grade psychological warfare propaganda, smearing the 30 pence a pill ivermectin COVID treatment, which could have saved 60,000 British lives, according to Bath's Dr. Tess Laurie, and Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity. We're all taken over now by Zelensky and the masochistic Russian sanctions. An unhappy bunch of Goldman Sachs Bilderberg losers, accelerationist cults waging war on the British people now, as well as Putin. So this is what the BBC might sound like if it was free from some of the tentacles of the authoritarian deep state lobbies. And navigating us through the Fourth Reich matrix this evening, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and those collaborators in the British establishment and mass media, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We're also joined by former editor of The Ecologist magazine, Oliver Tickell. More of a roundtable discussion this week. Also, hopefully joining us is our hostess, Farms Not Factories campaigner, Tracy Worcester. So part one this week, we'll be looking at the increase of the bank rate up to 4.25%. $750,000 people in Britain are now saying they can't pay their mortgage as this goes up. Isn't that a surprise? A million migrants, apparently, coming to our shores in 2022. And just to explain how everything is getting so much better, designer babies from three parents announced this week. Also, next week we'll be looking at, next week's programme will be from Lisbon in Portugal, a Bilderberg conference there, where Jake Sullivan from the National Security Committee in the USA, William Burns, director of the CIA, and a guy called James Baker, who dishes out the money for black operations, were all at the Bilderberg conference last year. And isn't it funny how just as the conference finished, so an exercise started, Baltops, it's called, Baltops, something to do with the Baltic, Nord Stream pipeline, bombs were planted on the Nord Stream pipeline, according to Charlie Skelton, journalist Charlie Skelton, who will be hopefully joining us next week, as well as, of course, Cy Hirsch, who did that brilliant article explaining from his inside sources who was really behind the bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline. In part two, we have an exclusive from Olya. She's a Russian woman living here in Gloucestershire, but she's born in Moscow, and her family are on both sides of the divide in the Donbass. So she has Russian and Ukrainian friends and family, and some of those Ukrainians from the Donbass too. So we don't often hear from Russians, do we? Especially those that have got people on both sides of the divide. Also, Imran Khan, apparently his arrest is illegal. He's being released at the moment, just right now, apparently being released. So the courts have intervened, where the Americans bribing the politicians plus the army wouldn't and couldn't. Also special this week, a look at the Rockefellers. Three pieces about those. There's a British security coordination in World War II. The Rockefellers involved with that. The Women's Lib, the involvement there, hearing from Aaron Russo. And finally, we're all Jews now, and the involvement of the Rockefellers in the medical profession. So Iranian and Russian news cancelled. In the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom, and then cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not yet cancelled here. So I think I should really start by introducing you, Oliver. Tell us a little bit about how you got to edit The Ecologist magazine.
Well, I had for a long time been involved in The Ecologist, but at a slight distance. In fact, I remember the first time I bought one. I was working in London and I went to my local health food shop, and I kept on seeing this
magazine. This was just near Baker Street in this health food shop. And it seemed to be coming up with all these really challenging ideas. You know, until then, I thought the World Bank was basically a good thing. I thought the Food and Agriculture Organization was a good thing, because it seemed that they were developing, you know, helping to develop the Third World, as we then called it, and bring a bit of prosperity and grow more food. And so what's not to like? Well, reading The Ecologist, I found out that there was a hell of a lot not to like. That, in fact, these organisations that were purporting to do one thing were, in fact, bringing about pretty much the complete opposite. While saying that they wanted to develop agriculture and make people richer and grow more food, what was really going on was that they were turning countries over to export-oriented cash crops. They were seeing ordinary farmers, we might call them peasants, small farmers in poor countries losing their land to large-scale plantation agriculture. I discovered that the World Bank would deliberately stimulate overproduction in particular sectors, coffee is a classic example, so as to keep prices down. And actually, at the same time, they would sell these loans to develop the coffee sector to countries. Vietnam is one very particular example, so as to flood the market with coffee. These loans would be predicated on receiving a high market price for that coffee, but the World Bank knew perfectly well that the increase in supply would do the exact opposite. It would bring prices down. So it was bringing cheap coffee to the West while actually bankrupting the poor countries who were producing because of the low prices that resulted from that overproduction. And then when they couldn't pay their loans, it was all handed over to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which would give them bailout loans, and these would come with all kinds of conditionalities, as they politely called them.
I can remember something called structural adjustment. So this was a very polite term for, well, we will make sure you don't go bankrupt as long as you do as we say.
Do exactly what we say. Open up your markets to foreign imports.
No, but this is basically a death trap. Not a death trap. Well, it actually, to a certain extent, it is, but it's called a debt trap, isn't it? Yes. This is effectively what these banks do.
Yeah, and funny enough, that's exactly what we are now, we, the West, are accusing China of doing, saying, isn't it terrible? You know, China's deliberately giving these guys money, you know, to build airports and ports or whatever, and they are getting into a debt trap. And I sort of think, well, maybe to some extent, but I think China has actually proven itself to be a much more forgiving lender than the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have ever been. And we are the experts in debt trap economics. It is as if we have rediscovered what Hitler's Chancellor Schacht developed in the years leading up to the Second World War, which he called the Raubwirtschaft, the robber economy. And it's a curious thing. If you try and find out more about the robbery economy, the Raubwirtschaft of Schacht, it's actually extraordinarily difficult to come across any information at all. You would have thought that this would be a subject of intense interest, but it's been pretty much completely excluded from any available literature.
Well, let's just try.
That's because we are doing it. You know, we are following what Schacht laid out to turn the entire world into a robbery economy, to impoverish and derive colonialized wealth from the resource-rich poorer countries?
Well, look, what Oliver's describing, Martin, there is an old colonial system which involved boots-on-the-ground troops being turned in the post-war world bit by bit, literally inch by inch, into this kind of debt slavery and actually a colonial system that's based on loans and about on financial control.
Well, in historical terms, it always was. It was a bit mixture of both, wasn't it? I mean, in the same era, they're still in, fighting in Vietnam and so on. Because, of course, Vietnam didn't want to be part of this system and has been drawn back into it now, subsequently. But, of course, you know, they had debt control over Turkey and Egypt in the 19th century when they built the Suez Canal and so on, which is why the British and the French ended up taking over in Egypt and then in Sudan, which, of course, didn't stop being a British colony till 1956 as a result of the revolution in Egypt. And I think these radical beginnings of ecologism are, you know, very important in my development as well. You know, I remember reading all these things at that sort of time and thinking, yes, the world is badly structured in exactly the way that you've described. But it's got worse, of course. It's actually intensified.
Yeah, but it's deliberate, isn't it? This is the point, is that it's actually just a kind of bit of a shape-shifting change. It's just a difference in the actual technique. Oliver, a lot of people look at the ecology movement now as something which was a sort of a Trojan horse, really, that's now brought in this whole zero-carbon world. And, you know, do you feel as if you were part of that Trojan horse to get everyone to think, well, you know, there's been this deliberate messing up of the environment through things like pesticides, fertilizers, this kind of thing, pollution generally, and now what's happening is there is an element within the green movement which is now saying we're going basically zero carbon, you back to the Stone Age. You can't have all of the things that bring about low levels of infant mortality, high prosperity anymore at all.
Well, Tony, I think that there are some elements of truth in that narrative that you set out there, but I also think that it is fundamentally wrong, and let me say why. Global warming, climate change, is real, and it is happening, and it is having immensely destructive effects all over the world. And, you know, right now there are massive forest fires in Canada, there is drought in Spain, and these things are just happening all over the world with ever-increasing frequency. It is real. But the curious thing is that carbon emissions aren't going down. Carbon emissions are actually going up. And ever since the climate change convention was signed and the Kyoto Protocol was put into effect, and with all of its market mechanisms and what have you, ever since then, carbon emissions have just increased, and they have increased at very much the maximum level that was ever foretold. And you look at America's policies right now, and indeed British policies are somewhat similar, but on the one hand, Biden has a really big program of renewable energy in America, and I think that is a good thing. But at the same time, we're getting new gas licenses, massive new oil and gas licenses given out. So it isn't that we are going to have clean energy to replace dirty energy, which I would see as a good thing. It's that we are somehow getting both, and carbon emissions keep on going up. And that is really a...
This is India and China, surely. That's what's going on. Is the developed world is now catching up, and it's saying, I mean, it may be saying very, very polite things at these COP summits, but it's sticking two fingers up to you and saying, you're not going to stop us industrialising.
Well, certainly China is experiencing a massive increase in demand for electricity. But they are also the world's biggest developer of renewable energy. Here in Britain, what we have achieved, and it was announced a day or two ago, and this has to be a good thing, is that our number one source of electricity is actually wind. So that certainly looks like progress. But a bit like America, we have a government that wants to keep on licensing coal mines, gas, oil, and perhaps an even bigger thing than that is that we are importing carbon-intensive products from around the world, meaning that our actual national carbon footprint, for all the apparent relatively good things we are doing, our carbon footprint is still going up.
Is that things like lithium batteries for the cars, that kind of stuff? It must be. I mean, we're still importing a tremendous amount of stuff. And I mean, we've heard from David Douglas from the National Union of Mine Workers, much information over the last few months about how much what we seem to have been doing is just outsourcing the environmental damage and saying, well, as long as we don't do it in the UK, it's okay. If we import, say, for example, coal, whatever, from abroad, that's being mined abroad, that's fine.
Well, certainly a lot of coal coming from abroad is produced in pretty appalling conditions, and Colombia is one very good example of that, which has actually been pretty well covered in The Ecologist. And anyone that goes to theecologist.org and types in coal and Colombia can find out all about that.
I mean, it's a bit like someone who plugs their electric car in to get it charged by gas or nuclear. You know, where actually what you really got is you got a nuclear car there. Is that really a good thing to have?
I think that is not a very good thing to have. But I also think that a petrol fuel car is not a very good thing to have. And I have to admit, I've got one.
Do you go to the Just Stop Oil demonstrations in your petrol car?
No. I mean, I think you've got to be some kind of nut to drive into London these days.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not the easiest place to get around in. Look, I mean, you and I share this a connection, I suppose, with the 1990s environmental direct action campaigns. And earlier this week, I spoke to someone we both know quite well, Dr. Chris Busby. You were talking to me about how he'd fallen out with George Monbiot many years ago. You know, this is actually back in the 1990s, where he was part of this thing he set up as part of the Green Party called the Green Committee of 100. And then George was supposed to be organising an occupation up at St George's Hill, which is the home of the diggers from the English Civil War, very close to my heart, big fan of Gerard Winstanley and everything that they stood for. And that actually ended up not being at St George's Hill, and Chris felt a bit betrayed by that. But so there were little squabbles that they had back in the 1990s, but much bigger now over things like nuclear and over George's articles, which have led to the funding, etc., being pulled from Dr. Chris Busby. And even, I mean, you know, you could argue that the witch hunt against Busby has led to the police raid as well against his home, where his laboratory was suspected of being a terrorist laboratory by the Devon and Cornwall police. But anyway, look, I thought I'd ask Chris about the 1990s and what happened then. And he explained to me a bit about how he set up this thing, which was an adjunct of the very radical Green Party in those days, called the Green Committee of 100.
I'm Chris Busby, and I'm reasonably well known for my anti, what you might call anti-nuclear science, which is quite successful at the moment. But there's something else that people don't know, and that is that I was the first coordinator of the Green Committee of 100, which was at the forefront of the direct action movement, which occurred in the 90s. And I put forward, together with David Taylor, at conference in Hastings, I think 1994 it was, the idea that, and it went into the Manifesto for a Sustainable Society, or it should have done, policy, that any sort of methodology for taking control of society or making the world a better place was to be permitted, so long as it involved non-violence, you know, so you didn't hurt anybody. So I was right at the front end of that non-violent direct action movement as the first coordinator of the Green Committee 100. A lot of people joined, so a lot of people, and we had a card index of about 300 people. The idea was that they would come to whatever, demonstrations or lying down in front of diggers or whatever it happened to be. And I was there at Salisbury Hill too on the BBC talking about this when everybody was lying down in front of the diggers there. And quite a few people did lie down in front of diggers and a lot of people got hurt. Anyway, we all had funny names. So I was Wasp. There was a guy called Black Dog. And then my daughter Celia was called Carly. And a lot of those people who you identify now, I suppose, with that movement, were all in the Green Committee of 100. The problem is we didn't have a lot of money, and so we used to meet down in Brixton, and people had to come long distances. And, of course, the kind of people that there were who did this were all very poor, so it was quite hard to sort all this stuff out. Anyway, we did a number of actions. The first action was Dungeness, which we'd done one in Trawsfynydd, nuclear power station in Wales. That was before this was set up, and we'd sort of chained ourselves to the gate, and nobody could get in or out. And eventually they closed Trawsfynydd, I think partly because of that. So we did Dungeness, which was down in Kent, and the police came and so on, but we were chained up, so nobody could go in and out and all the rest of it. In fact, I gave a lecture to the South Place Ethical Society, which is quite a posh outfit in London. They're based in Golden Square. And previous lecturers and include all sorts of important, you know, people like Bakunin and George Bernard Shaw and so on. So there I was on the menu there talking. And you can find this on the internet where I gave this lecture. They published the lecture about the ethics of nonviolent direct action. And basically what I said is that if the captain of the ship is a nutcase and they're not telling the crew the right, you know, what's correct about what's going on, you're entitled to take control of the ship. And this is certainly true of democracy, since democracy depends upon perfect knowledge. So if you tell the people in your democracy a load of lies and they vote for you, then and afterwards it looks like something bad is going to happen, you're entitled to, well, I mean, really, you're entitled to wrest control of the society, you see. And so that was the argument from the people who are running it, who are obviously dishonest and wrong. Anyway, so that was the basis of nonviolent direct action. And we did Dungeness. And the other thing we did was we broke into the flats opposite New Scotland Yard in order to, that were owned by some very rich people who just, you know, kept, they just bought them for making money. So we smashed our way into that and we put a load of people who were homeless in there. That didn't work out too well because most of the homeless people were drug addicts and nutcases and so on. So they were all beating each other up and it wasn't very, you know, our idea of a sort of perfect society in New Scotland Yard didn't work. And then the other, another one that we wanted to do was we wanted to do St. George's Hill, you know, the diggers. So around about 1995, this was all organized, but I left the organization to George Monbiot, who had sort of come in and joined us.
So that's Dr. Chris Busby talking to me earlier this week. He's very much a campaigner and a scientist. He had a bit of a success recently, Oliver, in a report that he did about depleted uranium, which he believes is going over to help the Ukrainians from the British armament stockpiles.
He has indeed. Chris did a lot of the research work on the health effects of depleted uranium in Serbia and in Iraq, where NATO troops made widespread use of depleted uranium munitions because these munitions are pretty much uniquely good at destroying tanks and armoured cars and other such things on the battlefield. But they do have this rather appalling side effect of leaving uranium ash. Now, this is depleted uranium, so it's uranium-238, which is the more mildly radioactive kind compared to the 235, which is used in fission. It has a whole complex range of effects on health, and this is what Chris figured out by looking at the health statistics. This very strong correlation between cancer and birth deformities arising from environmental contamination with depleted uranium. Now, his reports have been picked up actually around the world, except here. The countries that use depleted uranium, Britain, America, they have completely ignored it. You know, these reports might as well not exist.
To be fair, there's been a bit of coverage of it. Actually, a bit of criticism of the British army sending over these depleted uranium shells to Ukraine. Martin, I mean, this is a. Oliver really is our ecology expert here, but I'm sure you understand just as well as many of us do that this stuff persists in the environment indefinitely. Once you start using it, this is going to bring about genetic defects, and people from just eating a carrot, their children will maybe deformed, their children's children, and ad infinitum.
Well, I think the evidence is overwhelming, as has been said, and of course Chris Busby has obviously been a key player in bringing this to light. Do you remember the campaign, the woman campaigner in Bristol, whose name I've forgotten, Tony?
Oh, Jo Baker.
Jo Baker, because she used to go over to Iraq and look into all of the consequences for the people in Iraq. I think it's this supplying of depleted uranium to the Ukrainians is gratuitous, because in actual fact, what the Ukrainians are going to end up with is a very limited military use to them. Western military equipment, they're not trained to use it. Depleted uranium rounds, I believe the Russians have got them, but they haven't been using them. They use tungsten in their shells.
Yes, certainly that's what they've said.
Well, indeed. And of course, but don't forget that the Russians have got a vested interest in not using DU in the bits of the Ukraine that they're fighting over, because they intend to take those places over. So they certainly don't want a lot of depleted uranium around the place.
There's a perverse side to this, isn't there? Because not only are we making a hell of a mess once this stuff is used of the eastern half of Ukraine, and gets into the food chain and that sort of thing, but actually there is a kind of fueling of the war being done by not looking for peace, just adding weapons and more and more weapons to the situation. So, which was, by the way, was talked a little bit about, what we're hearing from later, by Vladimir Putin in his Victory Day speech this week. But before we move on to that, let's have another listen to Chris Busby, because we're talking here generally about the advancement of particularly nuclear power as an adjunct, really, to the nuclear weapons program, and the attempts to try and sanitize it and say, well, this is all fine, you know, well, actually it's causing a lot of problems. So one of the main campaigners back in the 1990s around nuclear energy and nuclear weapons was one of the leaders of the German Green Party, a woman called Petra Kelly, who Chris Busby got to know.
Petra Kelly was more or less the head of the German Greens, okay? And she was absolutely anti-nuclear, and the German Greens at that time were like an anti-nuclear party, is what they were. And so she... I think there was a reason for it. I think her sister died of leukemia or something like that. But anyway, my friend Bill Pritchard, who I stood in the election in 1994 in Wales on the basis that the Trawsfynydd nuclear power station was dangerous and it had all sorts of cracks in the pressure vessel and this and that, and they were trying to get it to continue to operate, and we had seen what happened in Chernobyl, so we wanted to stop it, and that was why we chained ourselves up and so forth. But he asked Petra Kelly to come and talk, to support him in that election, and she said yes, she was going to come from Germany. But then what happened is she was assassinated, and later in 1998 I met Ernest Sternglass in Munster. And I went there for a conference for the German Radiological Protection Society. And he told me that he met her, Petra Kelly, and she was really excited about all sorts of information that she got from some guy, a Russian scientist, who was going to blow the whistle on what was happening after Chernobyl, all the people who were dying, all the cancers, all the leukemias, this and that. And she had negotiated a series of programs with German TV to talk about the health effects of the Chernobyl accident. So we're talking 1994 now, 93. Anyway, just before she died. And so because everybody said, oh, she was really depressed. I mean, this was the story that came out from Sarah Parkin. Sarah Parkin wrote a book about this, you know, the life and death of Petra Kelly or something like that.
Almost misrepresenting it.
Yes, that's right. Sarah Parkin said in her book how depressed Petra Kelly was, and that's why she killed herself, see? But I mean, that was just a lie, because Ernest said that he talked to her And that she and this guy had this series that was coming out on German television, in which they're going to say how everybody was dying as a result of the radiation from Chernobyl. So then she dies, you see. And then afterwards, Sarah Parkin writes this book. She was certainly doing something in Dublin with this book about Petra Kelly. And my mate Scottish Dave went to talk to her about it, and he said, well, you know, Chris Busby says everybody is dying after Chernobyl. And she said, oh, well, you know, Chris Busby, like in that case, you know, I mean, my husband has done all the work on Chernobyl that shows there's no problem and so forth. So you have to ask the question why her husband, D.M. Parkin, was appointed to be the head of the people who investigate cancer in Lyon, in France, okay? And every single thing that comes out of that operation in Lyon shows how we don't really understand what causes cancer. Certainly radiation doesn't cause cancer. And they're always writing lots and lots of papers in which they give the definitive account of how radiation can't possibly cause cancer and all the rest of it. So that is a major operation run by D.M. Parkin, who is the husband of Sarah Parkin. And before that, he wasn't anything very special. He was just some kind of lecturer at the University of Birmingham. So you have to ask, how the hell did he get to be the head of such an important organization, you know, administering enormous amounts of money to researchers to prove that Chernobyl didn't cause any effects?
So that's Dr. Chris Busby, our final clip from him this evening. This whole idea of what happened to Petra Kelly, I don't know how much you know about it, Oliver, but it's pretty shocking, isn't it? It's almost like the mother of all conspiracies, that not only is this leading campaigner killed in Germany, Petra Kelly, and she was apparently found, the police eventually determined that she'd been shot dead whilst asleep, lying in her bed in 1992. But what Chris is alleging there is he's saying, well, the main people who are looking into the side effects of the nuclear industry and its increase in cancer rates are actually part of the same conspiracy to keep it quiet.
Well, it's a bit like the Queen is reputed to have said, there are powers on this earth of which we know nothing. Now, Tony, maybe you're one of the people that does actually know something about them, but it is the truth that people who come up with inconvenient truths that are revealing things about nuclear issues in particular, but other issues too, or who are driving successful campaigns and who are actually bringing about change, do have a way of dying that is just slightly extraordinary.
And it's also, you know, it's actually steered around policy. You know, there's a policy which is being decided somewhere else. And if either the press or the democratic institutions start to get in the way, that policy is reversed by one means or another. Someone is discredited, someone dies. Martin, what do you make of, you know, what happened to Petra Kelly? She was there as a major figure in Germany who was pushing back against the nuclear industry.
Well, she was also opposed to the stationing of nuclear weapons in Germany and the cruise missiles and Pershing missiles at the time. And apparently, as I remember, she had an ex-German general as her partner. So there's various reasons why she might be in the frame here, not just the nuclear industry. And, of course, it isn't just the nuclear industry that goes around bumping off its opponents. Michael Hastings, the journalist in the US who was investigating, I can't remember his name now, he's in charge in Afghanistan. His car looks as if it's been hacked. This is quite recently. You know, he's driving through a suburban area, 30 mile an hour zone or whatever, and then his car suddenly accelerates because it's been hacked and crashes into a wall. You remember who we're talking about, Tony?
I think there's a guy called Herrhausen.
Oh, yeah,
Herrhausen. As well.
Okay, Herrhausen. Well, that's interesting.
I mean, because he's somebody, you hear, oh, such and such has died, his car's exploded, and that's all you hear about it. But actually, he was a key guy.
Well,
German.
Herrhausen was important because he was the head of the Deutsche Bank. And in the early 90s, he was Helmut Kohl's personal intermediary with Gorbachev. So he went backwards and forwards to Moscow and back to Bonn to discuss what was going to happen when, you know, the changes took place. And what they'd agreed, and it made perfect sense, was that they would open up the Eastern Bloc to investments from the West and to integrate into the Western setup, but that they wouldn't immediately allow free access for imports into the Soviet Union from the West. In other words, they'd have to do some period of training where the German industrialists would invest in the Soviet Union, because they've got a very skilled workforce at very low wages, and then they would gradually build themselves up to the point where they could compete in the world market. All perfectly sensible stuff, and Gorbachev and Kohl had basically agreed this is what they were going to do. Herrhausen was the intermediary for this, but then he was kidnapped by the Red Brigades, not the Red Brigades, the Red Army faction, and assassinated. And Der Spiegel, which is a German, you know, serious magazine, pointed the finger, because of course these so-called left-wing terrorist groups are actually have been manipulated by the NATO intelligence operation, as we know from things that went on in Italy in the 70s. And in fact, the real world is actually much nastier than the average punter realizes. And what then tends to happen is if people talk about this stuff, they're obviously crazy, and therefore the ordinary population are just not allowed to think like this.
Oh, actually, you know, that is exactly what Chris Busby was saying there. He was saying, well, you know, people like Sarah Parkin is talking about this. Oh, well, Busby's just crazy.
Well, Sarah Parkin, it sounds like if her husband was involved in what was going on in Chernobyl, she may be. You see, don't forget the special demonstration squad in this country. It's come out in these inquiries. They had hundreds of undercover police officers forming relationships with activists. We live in a state not dissimilar to East Germany, but we just don't notice because they're better at it.
Well, what Chris is saying there was that Sarah Parkin wrote a book saying that Petra Kelly was getting very depressed and probably just killed herself, when actually the police say that she was shot whilst asleep.
Well, there you go. I mean, Gary Webb, who exposed the role of the CIA in the drugs trade in supplying the Nicaraguan Contras, they were using, they were basically getting cocaine from Colombia. The Nicaraguan Contras were bringing it into the US, and it was being distributed through the major cities through the drug gangs, all orchestrated by the CIA. He uncovered all of that. And of course, he then committed suicide, apparently, because he was depressed, again, because his career went down the drain, shot himself twice in the head, like you do when you commit suicide. And of course, he didn't commit suicide.
Maybe the first one missed.
Well, there you are. But the thing is that this stuff goes on. And of course, there's even a Hollywood film being made about it called Dark Alliance. Mm. Now, people who listen to this show will know that the CIA has been involved in the drug trade, goes back to the 1940s. But if you talk to an average punter, even a green voting punter, yeah, they will go, oh, gosh, I don't believe that. And that's, you know, they're able to create a kind of bubble around people where they just don't like to think that that sort of thing goes on. But, of course, the evidence for it is overwhelming after decades and decades.
Yeah, well, what's your thoughts? I mean, there's someone who's edited a national magazine here, Oliver, about the mass media, what we're getting on the television. I mean, I can imagine you, like me, you know, feel like throwing something at the TV sometimes.
Well, I haven't actually watched TV as such in a long time, and maybe that's why. But I think that one thing that I've increasingly come to realise is the essential role of mass media in perpetuating narratives that are generally reassuring, that everything that's going on is sort of good. Now, that narrative is occasionally interrupted by particular examples of things that are not in order and where things have gone wrong, but of course that is then used as an exemplar of how actually the system really is working, because these bad guys have been caught out and look, everything's actually working as it should.
So you're talking about really the criminal justice system, the parliamentary system, and the financial system. This is all, everything's kind of normal. Well, it's not, is it? Because
are living in a time of crisis. Well, in a time of the most enormous crisis. We're living in a time of economic crisis, ecological crisis, climate crisis, and actually existential crisis, because anybody who's really looking at this Ukraine war and what's going on there has got to ask themselves, how is this actually going to end? And there is no nice answer.
What's going to end in is Ukrainian victory.
Well, this is what we are being told, that that Ukrainian victory is somehow inevitable, but that if we stop sending massive and actually ever-increasing volumes of arms and aid to Ukraine, that actually it will fail. And Josep Borrell actually said this last week, that if we stop giving support to Ukraine, Ukraine will collapse in 2 days. So that's a very curious kind of a victory that Ukraine is achieving, that it'll all crumble after 2 days if we stop sending completely unprecedented volumes of cash and weapons and munitions of ever-increasing sophistication, that actually it'll all collapse. So what is actually happening is something very different. And there are huge parts of this narrative which, you know, of the truth of what is going on out there, which are completely excluded from what we are being told.
Well, we're going to talk a bit more about Ukraine later. But before, I'd like to play a clip. We had the Going Underground, Afsan Rishani from RT is now on Rumble, would you believe, doing his programme on RT, because you can't see it on RT, it's all been blocked by the NATO firewall. But he did a fantastic interview, I thought anyway, with the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins. We had a clip from that last week, and there's another short clip now, where he talks about the story of the book, how it actually came out.
When I first started to write the book, a long time ago, I contacted other people who'd had jobs like mine, and the jackals, the people who go in if the economic hitmen are unsuccessful and overthrow governments or supervise the overthrow of governments and sometimes even assassinate their leaders, is what happened to Allende in Chile and Arbenz in Guatemala and Mossadegh in Iran and on and on. The United States has admitted to many of these things. I contacted some of these people, and immediately I received anonymous phone calls threatening my life and threatening the life of my infant daughter. So, and at the same time, I was offered a very lucrative consulting job with Stone & Webster Engineering Company, who had been a major competitor of mine when I was chief economist at Charles T. Maine. And I'd quit that job and was writing this book. And they offered me an extremely lucrative consulting position, provided I didn't write the book. They knew I was working on the book. So I stopped. But then after 9/11, I knew I had to write the book. And I'm not saying there's any direct connection here at all. There isn't. But when I went to Ground Zero and looked down on that smoldering pit, I knew I had to come clean on what I'd done. And I decided this time I wouldn't tell anybody. I wouldn't contact anyone else. I would write a confession. I wrote the whole thing in secret, and then got it in the hands of a good New York agent who got it in the hands of publishing houses. And at that point, I figured it's my insurance policy, because, you know, anyone who might not like what I wrote, particularly in the government, would know that if something strange happened to me, the book would sell a lot more copies than the 2 million that it did sell.
So that's John Perkins there. Pretty frightening, isn't it? That, you know, if you want to get the stuff out, you've got to write a book as an insurance policy.
Well, yes, maybe I should write my book, Tony.
You have to do it in secret.
Or in fact, Tony, maybe I've already written it.
Ah. Martin, what do you make of Perkins? Because he's really describing an amazing thing going on there post-war, isn't he?
Yeah.
Where you've got these secret channels going into various governments, basically a mafia operation, threatening them with war and worse, and assassination if they don't do as they're told by the IMF.
Yeah, but also in relation to his own story, he was offered a lucrative job to shut up. And it's what they call in Mexico silver or lead, you know. You either play ball with us and we'll look after you, or nasty things will happen to you. It's, you know, that's what we're talking about. And I think the world at large, I was on a trade union delegation to Colombia in 2005, and people are being murdered every day in Colombia, even now. They've got a left-wing government for the first time in modern history, really. But the social activists and those who are former guerrillas and so on are still being murdered. And it's, you know, people we were seeing, visiting, were murdered while we were there. And it's a humbling, sobering experience. You know, I went to meet courageous people and I wasn't disappointed. But, of course, nobody in Colombia believes the sort of things that Middle England believes about the world, because they've got a different life experience.
Well, before we go any further, I'm going to ask both of you, you first, Oliver, is there a way out of this? Because it certainly doesn't seem to be going away, this kind of mafia system in the West, a secret government which is kind of controlling things from behind the scenes. The governments seem to be getting weaker and weaker. There's virtually no opposition now in the Houses of Parliament. And our press seems to be supine. It just doesn't report on stuff, which is uncomfortable.
Well, I think our press isn't so much supine. I think that they are in fact very active players in this, and that they are only too keen to be part of what one might call the imperial system. I don't think there is any reluctance among most journalists and most proprietors and most editors. And as far as a way out is concerned, it's actually hard to see one, because the power now of the security state, in the widest sense, you know, the security state, including not just people who are on a government payroll, but who are basically doing the bidding of those who are, is now so powerful. And the control of the media in shaping the narratives that form the basic framework of people's lives and how they see the world, and the amount of money that they have, and the power that they have, and the reach in terms of the things they can bring about. I mean, how is it that Julian Assange is in prison? I mean, we are the West. We stand up for freedom. We stand up for democracy. We stand up for freedom of speech. All of what are meant to be our fundamental values are, in fact, being completely contradicted in this single, undeniable fact of the punitive imprisonment of Julian Assange, who has committed no crime. How long has he been in prison for? It's a long time. He has committed no crime. There is no actual real crime of which he is accused, apart from a trumped-up charge in America. But he was imprisoned long before that. And it is just an extraordinary thing. There he is, not in just any prison, in the most high-security, destructive, horrific environment of any prison in the prison system. His legal status is he is a remand prisoner.
Just a minute. The point is, there's journalists and editors all across the country saying, I don't want to end up in Belmarsh, aren't there?
Well, there are, but in fact, they aren't bothered about that because they are loyal to the empire. They are loyal. They know that as long as they remain loyal and don't start kicking up a fuss about things and saying the wrong thing, that they are perfectly safe.
I mean, just the other week I was at the Journalists Union conference. I wouldn't necessarily say that. I say many of the journalists, particularly work in the in London, which is the centre for the national and international coverage in this country, would love to be let off the leash.
Well, they might love to be, but what we know is that if they start writing the wrong kind of article or producing the wrong kind of broadcast material, it just won't go out. Journalists can write what they like, but if the news desk gives it a thumbs down, and then that's it. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah, that's certainly true that an editor can. It's much more easy for an editor to spike an article than it used to be in the old days with the unions, because the journalists would actually... Well, we're talking here about
with the print unions.
Hot metal. The journalists would actually take the story to the typesetters and the editor wouldn't get involved. And it was a deal really between the journalist and the printer. The editor was kept out of the process back before Whopping, Martin, which you were at, weren't you?
Well, I wasn't at Wapping. I didn't work at Wapping, but we used to go down there quite frequently because it was a very long-running dispute in the, you know, it's right in the heart of London there.
And that was Murdoch, of course, who now has decided, well, he's not actually sacked Tucker Carlson. I mean, we've been having quite a lot of clips from Tucker Carlson on Fox News on our programme, particularly more recently. I mean, he was doing stuff to do with the Wuhan lab and the Pentagon research going on over there on gain of function, being, you know, one of the main suspects behind the COVID virus. But it was also the bio labs in Ukraine. I mean, goodness me, that is such an explosive story that you've got the United States government under Obama shutting down dangerous biological weapons research in the United States. So some smart aleck at the Pentagon said, oh, I've got some friends in Ukraine, we can go and just set up and do this over there. This is something which has obviously annoyed some people somewhere. But whatever, Tucker Carlson has been taken off the air by Murdoch, almost certainly, in my view, in a well, it's an out-of-court settlement, we know that, but probably a non-disclosure agreement as part of that. So although in fact it may even be that Tucker Carlson himself hasn't been told why he's been sacked under a non-disclosure agreement.
Well, I think we know very well why he's been sacked, don't you, Tony? Which is because he has actually been broadcasting objective, fact-based journalism about this war in Ukraine, and in doing that he has just completely deviated from the line that is being taken by pretty much the entire media of the United States and other NATO countries, and this is a dangerous thing. And what makes it particularly dangerous is that viewers love it. Because fundamentally, the story that Tucker Carlson has been telling makes sense. It is in accord with known facts for people that have a memory going back to 2014 and before. This is a narrative that actually fits in with the facts that people remember and know. And it actually explains what's going on in a way that makes sense. And in order to believe the imperial narrative, you have to be either memory deficient or lack any kind of critical faculties or simply not know, which makes me think that the real function of the media in such cases is actually to keep people lulled in a state of ignorance and non-critical thinking. Someone that comes along and breaks that and actually presents a clear, believable narrative that fits with the court facts is dangerous. They actually threaten the entire imperial system.
There is a massively fascinating psychological side to all of this, and it's almost as if, you know, the West is a kind of organism, a person that can an individual be self-critical? This is the whole point, you know, really. If an individual just simply surrounds themselves with people that agree with them, then you end up with a sycophantic kind of inability to see any of your own faults, and a kind of power-crazed thing develops. So in a way, the West is like an individual which simply is refusing to accept any criticism of itself, a bit like the, you know, the fall of Rome, you know, when the powerful just see anybody that makes any, even a constructive and friendly criticism, as the enemy.
Well, that is exactly how it is. It's the "if you're not with us, you're against us" complex. And this is why Tucker Carlson is important, and this is why the world is looking to see what's he going to do next.
Well, I can tell you what he's going to do next. He's going on to Twitter.
"Hey, it's Tucker Carlson. You often hear people say the news is full of lies, but most of the time that's not exactly right. Much of what you see on television or read the New York Times is in fact true in the literal sense. It could pass one of the media's own fact checks. Lawyers would be willing to sign off on it. In fact, they may have. But that doesn't make it true. It's not true. At the most basic level, the news you consume is a lie of the stealthiest and most insidious kind. Facts have been withheld on purpose, along with proportion and perspective. You are being manipulated. How does that work? Let's see. If I tell you that a man has been unjustly arrested for armed robbery, that is not, strictly speaking, a lie. He may have been framed. At this point, there's been no trial, so no one can really say. But if I don't mention the fact that the same man has been arrested for the same crime six times before, am I really informing you? No, I'm not. I'm misleading you. And that's what the news media are doing in every story that matters, every day of the week, every week of the year. What's it like to work in a system like that? After more than 30 years in the middle of it, we could tell you stories. The best you can hope for in the news business at this point is the freedom to tell the fullest truth that you can. But there are always limits. And you know that if you bump up against those limits often enough, you will be fired for it. That's not a guess. It's guaranteed. Every person who works in English language media understands that. The rule of what you can't say defines everything. It's filthy, really, and it's utterly corrupting. You can't have a free society if people aren't allowed to say what they think is true. Speech is the fundamental prerequisite for democracy. That's why it's enshrined in the first of our constitutional amendments. Amazingly, as of tonight, there aren't many platforms left that allow free speech. The last big one remaining in the world, the only one, is Twitter, where we are now. Twitter has long served as the place where our national conversation incubates and develops. Twitter is not a partisan site. Everybody's allowed here, and we think that's a good thing. And yet, for the most part, the news that you see analyzed on Twitter comes from media organizations that are themselves thinly disguised propaganda outlets. You see it on cable news. You talk about it on Twitter. The result may feel like a debate, but actually the gatekeepers are still in charge. We think that's a bad system. We know exactly how it works, and we're sick of it. Starting soon, we'll be bringing a new version of the show we've been doing for the last 6.5 years to Twitter. We'll be bringing some other things, too, which we'll tell you about. But for now, we're just grateful to be here. Free speech is the main right that you have. Without it, you have no others. See you soon.
So that's Tucker Carlson speaking on Twitter this week. I mean, I think, Oliver, you'll probably find his show will be a bit shorter if he has to do the constraints of, I think it's 3 minutes and 20 seconds maximum on Twitter for a video.
Well, let's see how that works out. For me, I mean, one big question is I've been reading accounts and actually through Tucker Carlson's own Telegram channel, that he might be running as president. He might be running for president. And that is something that really would blow the forthcoming presidential race wide open in a way that nothing else could.
Well, certainly, even if he doesn't, it's a way of getting the other Republican candidates rattled. Martin, I mean, I know you're not a massive fan of Tucker Carlson, but when he's talking there about the way the news is manipulated, he's talking about it as an insider, isn't he?
Yeah, and of course, if, you know, being sacked from anything is quite normal. You know, if Murdoch doesn't like your stuff, it's his... It's his TV station.
Let's be absolutely clear here, right? I don't think that Carlson has been sacked because Murdoch doesn't like his stuff. He's been sacked in this part of this Dominion voting machine.
Well, you're speculating, Tony.
Well, you have to speculate because of the way of the use of these non-disclosure agreements in these out-of-court settlements which use non-disclosure agreements, you have to just basically look at what's been going on and make your own decision because they're never going to tell you. And that's the news media for you.
Well, I mean, all of these things that we're talking about, the devil is in the detail. And that is obviously what we're trying to do.
His ratings were enormous. But the thing is, the advertisers have been pulling out.
That's right. So it doesn't matter whether the advertisers don't want you. If your boss doesn't want you, Murdoch has flip-flopped around, as you know, politically. He's decided that he's not going to, you know, he didn't in the end go with, you know, he could have gone to court and testified that they'd proved that the Dominion voting company.
The thing is, he may have lost the whole of his company.
This is what Dominion voting did because they're a multinational company as well, and they say you are damaging our reputation. We are demanding damages of X.
Can we damage their reputation right now and say I wouldn't trust a Dominion voting machine as far as I could throw?
But the point is, it's not been tested in court, Tony. It's just just us chatting over a microphone. Now, what Murdoch bottled out there was going to court, because what may have turned out, in fact, that they didn't cheat. And, of course, obviously this is a big issue in the US, whether the election was stolen or not, especially on the right. But what I would point out to those people is this. Unlike Russian elections, which are under a proportional system, the first-past-the-post system in the US and the electoral college system, which means that all the votes in a particular state go to one side or the other. The actual vote isn't broken down. There is when Hillary Clinton lost to Trump, she conceded immediately, but it was quite clear that she had 4 million votes more than Trump. Now, the system in the US is the Democrats have to actually get millions of more votes than the Republicans in order to win. Now, that didn't matter back in the day when there was a unipolar world, but they're now in direct competition with the Russian system, which has actually evolved very, very surprisingly from very, very undemocratic origins into being actually a well-run system.
Okay, well,
with several political parties. United Russia is dominant, but in actual fact, the political system in Russia is actually very functional, and in a way that ours is not.
I'd like to give you your chance anyway, because we've been talking about the way the world is run through the IMF, these debt traps that are run, the economic hitmen, the jackals, the idea that the United States and the IMF can send people in to assassinate those that don't make agreements with the IMF, that sort of thing. Is there any way to fix it?
Well, what's happening is that the Russians, the Chinese, and now it looks increasingly like the Indians and the Turks, not to mention the Brazilians and the South Africans, are fed up with this. And, of course, neither Russia nor China owes a penny to the West. The Russians paid off all of their debts. They went through all sorts of struggle to do that. And look at the way the sanctions have played out. It's European economy, the Western and Eastern European economies, which are going to crash. I was talking to a Polish guy at a party last week, and it's idiotic for the Poles to cheer about smashing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. That will crash the German economy. The Polish economy is virtually entirely dependent on the German economy. I used to live in Poland. I know these things. And they will all be put out of work as a result of this. But people in Russia will not. People in China will not. They're actually running ahead. Glazyev, who's Putin's economic advisor, is developing an alternative currency to the dollar with the Chinese. The Saudis have decided that they're prepared to sell oil for not for dollars. They should be looking out for a military coup against them. But of course, what's happening now is World War III. That's what it is. And it's quite possible that the West will lose. And that's the outcome of this. Let's hope it doesn't end in a nuclear war, because if it doesn't end in a nuclear war, there's a possibility that the West will simply lose. And then they won't have the power that they've had for the last 500 years. Things will be different.
I mean, surely the Chinese, the Russians, they're not playing with kid gloves, are they? They are playing hardball too. For example, when they're dealing with African governments trying to get their investment opportunities into there.
Well, you could argue that, but as Oliver pointed out earlier, they keep going about the Chinese debt trap. Because the Chinese have a mixed economy, where the commanding heights of the economy, like the banks and the oil and gas industries, are under national
control.
Not
least of which is the things like the water, the basics, transport, like that.
That's right. So they haven't privatised all of that. So the Chinese National Oil Corporation can turn up in a country and say, right, we'd like to do some, you know, extraction of oil. Because the Chinese, one of the reasons why the Chinese are so keen on alternative technologies is because they haven't got any oil. This is why the Japanese went nuclear, because they didn't have any oil. And of course, these things are really geopolitical decisions are made around these things.
So they must have made a decision. They were saying, well, we can buy cheap oil from the Russians, but we don't want to be dependent on them.
Well, no, the recent rapprochement between the Chinese and the Russians, the Chinese were looking at trying to get non-oil alternatives for years and years and years and years and years, because they didn't have any. So they had to. It was important for them to do that, which is why they invested so much in alternative technology.
Why haven't we got a mixed economy still, Oliver? I mean, it seems to me a sensible way to do things, where you've got the government running the infrastructure, trying to make sure it's near as cost as possible. If people are getting around in transport, buying water for their family, to fill the bath, to give the kids a drink of water, this sort of thing. The idea that that's all, people are profiteering off of that, seems wrong.
Yes, well, this takes us back to the Thatcher era. And when there was this idea that privatizing everything was this fantastically good thing, pioneered, of course, by Pinochet in Chile under the guidance of the Chicago Boys School of Economists. And there are two questions, really. One of them is, why did Mrs. Thatcher and her government think it was such a good thing? And there may have been a certain measure of naive enthusiasm and thinking that private companies really would run these public services more efficiently, that they would mobilise more investment, that competition would bring prices down, and that we would all somehow be better off. Maybe there really was that element of idealism, a sort of economic idealism, that it would all be great. But what we actually see now that it's happened, I mean, the first thing I'd like to draw attention to is just how much we have lost. Because, you know, back in the 1970s, we didn't know how wealthy we were. We, the people, in fact, had an enormous wealth in all of these either nationally owned company or mutually owned building societies and insurance companies and other financial institutions.
At the time, they talked about it as selling off the family silver, didn't they?
Yes, but actually it was much more than the family silver, if you think. You know, how important is the family silver to a typical household? Most households haven't got family silver anyway, and if they have, well, they can go to IKEA and buy stainless steel cutlery for sort of 20, 30 quid to replace it. You know, it is so much more. It is actually selling your own house and renting it back. And this is the position that we have put ourselves in. But we owned so much, and it's only now really that it is starting to dawn on people what we have lost.
Well, I mean, last night on the BBC Question Time, there was a I thought excellent discussion about what's going on with water at the moment. I think it was on the south coast somewhere that the program was recorded, and they turned it around in about an hour, so they broadcast it an hour after it's recorded, so it's pretty almost live. They can't quite bear to have it live in case anyone says anything too controversial, I suppose. And then someone from Antiques Roadshow running the show doesn't notice a fact that's gone completely wrong or whatever. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to a discussion. We had our own very own Bristol West MP, Thangam Debonair, who seems to become a favourite spokesperson for the Labour Party on there, talking about the possibility of privatising water, but in the context also not only of the enormous amounts of sewage which is being dumped into our rivers these days, but also the bringing back into nationalised ownership the Transpennine Rail.
Yes, well, I live here in Bexhill, and I go out fishing with the East Hastings Angling Association. 2 miles out to sea from the beach here, there's an outflow from the pipe, which is raw sewage. Every time we go there, it's pumping it out. It's being swept in here. People no longer swim. There used to be loads of swimmers along the seafront here. Now they're not.
Some do, because I bumped into three of them.
Well, yeah,
looking very chilly as they just got out this morning.
Well, they're the Bexhill plungers. But here's the point. Every single one of us who owns a house or property has to pay for fresh water and also for wastewater. Now, so long as this sewage is still being pumped into our sea, I say we should be legally allowed to withhold the money for the wastewater.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Like that. So, privatised water companies paid out £1.4 billion in shareholder dividends last year. And 20%...
And that's analysis by the Financial Times.
And 20% of your water bill is going towards shareholder profits and managing the debt for those privatised companies. Does that seem like a good use of your money? Do you feel you're getting good value for your money? Would you rather that money was going into fixing the infrastructure?
Yes!
While these companies remain in private hands, there's no incentive for them to do it. There is simply no incentive. So Southern Water is mostly owned by an Australian investment firm, and it's partially owned by the American mega bank JP Morgan. So your water bills are going towards making foreign corporations rich, and because they are so fabulously rich, they can just eat up whatever fine the government decides to levy them with. And while it would be very satisfying to see some of these CEOs in jail, and I would love it personally, what I fear is that the incentive hasn't gone away, which is you underinvest in the infrastructure, you let it crumble, because, you know, you don't live there. You live in Manhattan or somewhere gorgeous. You don't have to worry about the sea in Bexhill. And instead, the incentive is to extract money from the system that could go towards fixing infrastructure, and you put it towards shareholder dividends. It makes financial sense at this point to bring this industry back into state control so all of the money can go towards fixing the problems. And of course, the Tories don't really want to do that. They only nationalise things at the last possible minute, as they have with the Trans-Pennine Express. But what confuses me is that Labour aren't committing to it either, when it would save so much public money. And it would mean that these problems would get fixed because you guys would be democratically accountable. You're not in Australia. You're not in Wall Street. You're right here where we can see you.
Why not nationalise it?
We rejoiced today when the Tories finally worked out that actually taking the railways back into public ownership was important. In relation to water, we would have to pay the current owners. This is not a public company. I regretted that bitterly. I did not want the water companies to be sold off in the first place. But where we are at the moment is they do legally own to private companies. They belong to private companies.
No, but we know that. Ash's point is, why not nationalise them? Would Labour nationalise them? That's the question she's asking.
Because the cost of repaying them is astronomical. And I don't want to spend taxpayers' money on that when I know that taxpayers are telling me that they want the money spending on our hospitals, on our schools, on our potholes, as we discussed earlier, before the show, when we were chatting. I think it is really, really important that we're clear. Privatising the water companies would cost money. Nationalising the water companies would cost money. Bringing the railways back into national ownership is simply a matter of waiting for their tender to come up and then taking it back. Or, as the government has finally done today, saying, up with this, we will no longer put. I don't want to spend taxpayers' money on water companies, on water company shareholders, when I could spend it on schools. And that's where I want your money to go, because I know that you work hard for it and there's not a lot of it going round at the moment. And when we spend your money, we do so on your behalf. We can't just spend it on everything that we would like to. We need to spend it on the priorities you
have. We hear you. I'm going to take another question. Was that a kind of... I know.
It's actually a brilliant bit of presenting by our Antiques Roadshow lady, Fiona Bruce, there, where Martin, I'm afraid, you know, she's saying, well, the audience don't seem very enthused by Thangam's response there, saying, oh, well, it's impossible for us to renationalise the water system in the country. It would just cost too much. We need to spend that money on our schools and our hospitals and filling in potholes.
Well, in a sense, she's right, because if you just buy the water companies back at the current, they've got monopoly profits, so their shares are very expensive. You know, they're worth buying. So if you were going to just give the money to put it back into public ownership, you can see that there'd be an issue there.
I don't know if people realise, but if you buy something like £7,000-£8,000 worth of water company shares, the dividends just pay your water bill.
Well, indeed. So
you don't pay any water bill.
Now, what you could do is to two things. You could see that she's right about the railway companies, because their franchise just runs out, so you can just cancel it. Yeah, that's quite straightforward. The water companies have now basically got themselves into a position of monopoly power, and they've basically made a load of money out of this. The shares were sold at far less than they're actually worth, same as the shares in the gas industry.
You agree with Thangam?
Well, I'm just trying to pass this slightly.
Go on,
The audience would like to hear we're going to renationalise it. I think you can renationalise it. But first of all, you've got to regulate it so they're not making any money. So you sting them with fines, you make the shares go down because you make it impossible for the shareholders
incredible
and then you can buy them at a discount price.
Incredible
they will give them to you.
About that discussion, it's quite a lot of the money we're now paying on our water bills, never mind gas and electricity, is going to service debt of JP Morgan and various other companies that own these.
What they've done is actually very clever, because a friend of mine, Matt Prescott, wrote a very interesting report on Thames Water and their financial structure, which goes back to when the company was owned by Macquarie Bank, a rather notorious Australian bank, which is known for its sometimes predatory approach to lending and to asset management. And what they managed to do was to run up enormous debt in Thames Water. What was that debt used for? It was used to pay dividends. They weren't borrowing money to improve infrastructure or invest in water supply, by and large. They were using it to pay dividends to their shareholder, and that shareholder was itself. So they were lending the company money in order to then have it given back to them as dividends, and at the same time saddling the company with all of this enormous long-term debt. In a way, this is another example of the robber economy in action, but this was actually robbing their own company in order to monstrously enrich themselves, and then they sold it on with all of that debt still owned by them, so that they continue to receive, and debt issued on not very favourable terms, so that they continue to receive a long-term debt interest dividend from that company. Now, this is a very clever thing to do from the point of view of tax efficiency, from the point of view of increasing their wealth. But what it's doing is creating a hollowed out company. And I think that to some extent, pretty much the same thing has happened to all of these companies, that they are hollowed out, that they are carrying huge amounts of debt. They're actually financially quite vulnerable. They continue to turn out profits and paid dividends precisely because they are not being held to what are actually legal standards of environmental performance. All of this sewage that is being dumped in seas and rivers is actually technically against the law. So how are they doing it? Well, at the same time, the government has been underfunding the Environment Agency. They are generally reluctant to prosecute because the costs of prosecution are very high, and they don't have the staff to actually carry out the research on anything like the necessary scale to investigate incidents of polluting. And the Environment Agency is increasingly a creature of government that simply follows government policy. And the government has, I'm sure, made it completely clear to them they do not want them to go out enforcing the law. And if they were to go out and do their absolute best to enforce the law and to hold these companies to account and bring massive fines out of them, well, the government would probably give them even less money just to make sure that they couldn't do it. So this is what's going on, and this is why Martin is absolutely right. We actually need that regulatory regime to force them to invest, and then this whole hollowing out of the companies that has been going on will actually count against them. And actually, what will happen, and I think that this is what should happen by design, is that these companies should be made bankrupt. They are so indebted, and of course, you know, so much of the money is being paid out in debt service, that the answer is not just to bring their share price down. It is to make these shares worth nothing and to completely wipe out the loans that have been granted by the likes of Macquarie Bank, so that suddenly, with the company's bankruptcy, all of these loans are worth nothing. And at that point, the state can step in and take these companies over at zero cost.
Yeah, it would be nice if that was even possible to happen. Anyway, thanks for both of you for looking at that whole... I mean, water is the most fundamental thing in the world, really. We all need a little sip of it at least once a day, and we start to keel over. And it's quite a good idea if it's not poisoned or full of sewage. And if a privatised system can't get that right, then that needs to change, quite obviously. And this is something which I think characterises the West now, as opposed to so many other countries in the world, including the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Indians. Many of these countries understand fundamentally that you have to have this infrastructure in state hands, managed in the open rather than behind closed doors, for the benefit of the public. And we had last week the announcement of the sacking from the Conservative Party of the MP Andrew Bridgen, and a fascinating discussion between Dr. John Campbell and him, which was one of Campbell's strikes on his YouTube channel. He was rather disgruntled that many millions and millions of views that he has on his YouTube channel. I'm actually quite annoyed about my public inquiry channel being taken down. I had three strikes, the final one of which was for a film which I put up before the guidelines that they used to take it down on YouTube. So obviously you're not really dealing with fair people there. I said stupidly, I suppose, innocently sent them a little message saying, hang on, you've taken this video down, but what you're criticising it for is something that you didn't introduce until after the video was uploaded. So about 3 or 4 months, actually, my video was up. But anyway, they took my channel down with something like 15 million views. And there, I mean, he's got many, many more, Dr. John Campbell, but he got a strike for this, and this was taken down. So one of the things I love to do on this program is to share with you the sorts of information that YouTube doesn't want you to hear.
When I speak even to an empty house, an empty chamber, that is recorded in Hansard, and it does go out as a video clip. I think it's the narrative that we're up against to get to the truth and the science. I think it's fairly damning when YouTube will take down a speech with a response from a minister from the mother of all parliaments for 3 days because it violates their community guidelines. That is deeply worrying. I did give a speech a couple of weekends ago in Norway, in Stavanger, to a conference on these issues. And I stood up on the stage, and it was a packed audience. And I said, I'm actually feeling a little intimidated. I'm only actually used to speaking to an empty room.
Who's paying for these vaccines, Andrew? They're costing us billions, aren't they?
With the taxpayers paying for the vaccines.
Have we got plenty of spare cash at the moment?
We know it'll be going on the national debt. And I think that's... the last speech I gave on the 17th of March on the vaccines, I did point out the cost of the number to vaccinate to prevent one hospitalisation or one serious hospitalisation. And it's interesting that after that speech, within a few days, the criteria was moved to only the over 75s.
Yeah.
And it did mention for the first time value for money.
Mm.
There is no money. There's no government money. It's all taxpayers' money. Mm. I think a large number of our parliament have forgotten that. Mm-hmm. I think some of them also have forgotten that we're not the masters of the people, we're the servants of the people. And I think the next election may be an opportunity to remind a few people a few facts of life.
Absolutely, yeah. Answer this to the degree you see fit, Andrew, of course, and bear in mind this is a public domain channel, but is there influence of corporate interests in Parliament?
I think people know that the current parliamentary system we've got, it doesn't appear to be working for the people anymore, and I actually have said publicly that I'm very, very concerned that what we should be doing, and I thought we used to do, was we passed laws and legislation on behalf of the people, for the people, mm-hmm. and now it appears that we actually have a whole parliament, not even a government, but a whole parliament that's conspiring to inflict laws upon the people, and that is not democracy. And the use of Project Fear and the PSYOPs during the pandemic. And also, John, I mean, I like to, when my constituents come to me with problems, as they do, and they can be anything from the front door to my council house needs replacing to, very personal issues. Yeah. I like to, they're clearly worried. I always try and reassure them and say, now that you've told me and my team, you know, it's normally on a Friday, I want you to have, you know, relax this weekend because we'll deal with this now. Mm. You know, have confidence. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think governments should be there for, to look at the problems the country faces and deal with them and let the people get on with their lives. But what we've seen increasingly is every issue from pandemics to climate change, it seems to be pushing the concern onto the people instead of dealing with the problems that the country and the world faces and let people get on with their lives. It's almost making people feel responsible for these issues. You're the problem. And I find that deeply, deeply worrying and unpalatable, quite honestly. And it's the anathema of what I came into politics for.
I mean, Bridgen is describing Martin there, Conservative MP, a parliament which is, I think it's fair to say it's turned on the people. I mean, certainly, as a young man, I remember them bringing in things like food labelling regulations. These are the sort of things you want. Now we're in a situation where the industry lobbies to make sure that nobody knows whether there's pesticides on your lettuce when you buy it.
Well, just to pick up a certain point, he's not a member of the Conservative Party anymore, has he? He's been expelled, hasn't he? So he's an independent. He's sitting as an independent.
Well, he's just joined Lawrence Fox's party this week.
Okay.
So he's their only MP.
Well, you know, he...
I think they're called the Reclaim Party.
Yes, okay. Well, the system has always been rotten. The idea that it was okay in the past and it's gradually gone down the drain. And
I use that, I think, very basic example from the 1970s when the Wilson government introduced food labelling. This is useful for the consumer. Now, the lobbying power has changed. It's reversed. And so that the food companies say, for example, if they've irradiated food or if there's pesticides on the food you're about to buy, you're not being told.
That's, listen, there was the possibility of some kind of reformism. I was alive in that era, I remember. There was a kind of progressive sort of direction of society and so on and so forth.
We could almost feel Jeremy Corbyn kind of hovering around above us here, saying, well, actually, maybe things would have changed if I would have been more successful.
Well, indeed, but the whole thing is rigged. And Andrew Budgeon, a member of the Conservative Party as he previously was, and we were talking earlier about the Thatcher era, no doubt he regarded all of that as good thing. And
actually,
of course,
the funny thing is, the funny thing is actually, the Tories even seem to be more vociferous about renationalising industries than the Labour Party do.
Well, I think what's happened is that the reality is that the train companies just have to be taken back into the public sector. They can't manage. And I think what may happen with the water industry and all these other industries, if we're really serious about going to war with Russia, and that's what the head of the British Army seems to be saying, then I think we're going to have to just nationalise without compensation and have a war plan. And that's what one side of the Conservative Party are coming out of their mouth, and the other side are saying, oh, we're going to have tax cuts for the wealthy and more privatisation.
Well, I think that's a Labour Party plan too. But anyway, Oliver, what do you make of Andrew Bridgen's description there of a parliament which is now actually actively working against the population that votes it in?
Well, I think it's true, and this is actually something I've been having a dialogue with a friend of mine who is very anti-monarchy. On this very topic, and actually in carrying out this dialogue, I suppose I've actually reached a view which is perhaps not a very obvious one. What are the reasons to be pro-monarchist? You might think it's a ridiculous system. It's who on earth would invent a system like that? Well, what on earth is the use of it? Let's be democratic. Let's elect our head of state. Now, the problem with that is, if you look at our elected democratic institutions, those are the very ones that are failing us. It is actually Parliament elected, the elected House is failing us. It is the Prime Minister who is failing us. And perhaps especially, of course, recently retired or sacked prime ministers. So it is actually our democratic institutions that seem to be most susceptible to total failure. And there's a headline in the Daily Mail from a few days ago saying that actually it was Charles, this is when he was Prince Charles, who was taking on the British government at that time about its pretty horrible and ultimately illegal in international law asylum policy, which the Daily Mail is itself championing. But it was the Daily Mail that revealed that Prince Charles was actually playing what I think is an important constitutional role before he became head of state in actually trying to restrain the extremes and the really rather fascistic extremes of the government of that time. And I think that this is a very good and proper role. And if you look at the House of Lords, it is actually the House of Lords, for all its faults, and it has many faults, but for all its faults and for all the fact that no one would have dreamed it up as any kind of usefully functioning upper house, but it is the Lords which is actually trying to make what is often a dog's breakfast of legislation, of unworkable legislation coming at it from the elected house, and it is they that are trying to turn it into some kind of law that has some kind of prospect of working and in some way serving a public interest. And I think that the monarchy is about the only thing, the only institution that we really have left. The House of Lords can, of course, ultimately be overruled. But the monarchy is actually the principal institution that we have that is capable, that is constitutionally capable of resisting the excesses of the House of Commons, and in particular the person of the Prime Minister, which has taken over the royal prerogative and which, as we saw particularly under Boris Johnson, is able to use the royal prerogative to overcome any kind of democratic will. And in fact, I rather see, and Neil Oliver was saying something rather similar on GB News not very long ago, that it is that one of the most damaging things, one of the most dangerous things that we have is the usurpation by ultimately, I believe, treacherous prime ministers acting against the interests of the country and its people of this unbelievably powerful royal prerogative to do pretty much whatever they like against us.
Okay, so so let's have a listen to the new King Charles, was as he was then Prince Charles, back in 2020, as he announced the Great Reset as this kind of putting us on a warlike footing, because he's definitely very different characteristics. And maybe after we've heard this, we can discuss the merits or otherwise of being allowed to protest against him.
Without swift and immediate action at an unprecedented pace and scale, we will miss the window of opportunity to reset for a green-blue recovery and a more sustainable and inclusive future. In other words, the global pandemic is a wake-up call we simply cannot ignore. Having been at this now for well over 40 years, I have long observed that people tend not to act until there is a real crisis. Ladies and gentlemen, that crisis has been with us for far too many years, decried, denigrated, and denied. It is now rapidly becoming a comprehensive catastrophe that will dwarf the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. At this late stage, I can see no other way forward but to call for a Marshall-like plan for nature, people, and planet. With the planetary emergency so critical, with the permafrost melting in Siberia, for instance, producing dire effects on global warming, and with the Pantanal in Brazil being consumed by unprecedented numbers of fires, we can no longer go on like this, as if there was no tomorrow and no ultimate reckoning for our abuse of nature. So, what do we do? Without doubt, we must now put ourselves on a warlike footing, approaching our action from the perspective of a military-style campaign. That way, working together, we can combat this most grave and urgent challenge. If we have the resolve to shift our trajectory, we must start now by bringing forward our net zero target.
OK, maybe you first, Martin. He's actually in charge of the military, and there he is saying, right, I'm going to marshal the whole country, really.
Well, it's interesting you use the term Marshall Plan, because it's named after General Marshall, of course, who was second in command of the US military in World War II and then was tasked with drawing up a plan to reflate the Western European economy through long-term investments as a means of salvaging capitalism from the danger of communist takeovers, which had happened in Eastern Europe and in France.
It's almost like a war plan, a military-type plan, isn't it?
Yes, but I mean, on that point, I would point out that at COP 20, whenever it was, 22, was it 22 when they went to Glasgow? The original Bretton Woods conference in 1944, the top money people were not invited. The Wall Street bankers didn't go to Bretton Woods. It was politicians, civil servants, and military men like Marshall. Marshall was in charge of the Marshall Plan, not Jamie Dimon or anybody else.
They were keeping the financial people in their box. Basically.
They were keeping the financial people in their box. Whereas what happened with the climate summit is all of these top billionaires jetted in to join in and put their tuppence halfpenny into the debate. Mm. And that's because the whole way of, whatever you think of climate change, the policy of trying to deal with it is being driven by capitalist interests.
Because King Charles is leading a consensus here. Everyone agrees, apparently.
The consensus of these, what's happened is that the corporate world, including BlackRock and Vanguard and all these big financial private equity companies, they have latched onto the idea of climate change, getting rid of, dealing with climate change as a mechanism for rescuing capitalism. Because what should have happened, of course, is that the banking system could easily have been allowed to collapse in 2008, and we could have rebuilt from scratch, and we didn't have to have any of these people. But of course they were rescued, and now they're looking for a purpose, and that purpose is saving us all from global warming, which then leads to cynicism from people about what's going on. I'm cynical about these people. I don't trust them to do the job.
It's a fake consensus, isn't it, really? They've just got together and decided something beforehand, and they're saying, well, everyone's agreed, well, the banks and King Charles and various other people have agreed, and you're not really going to get a say in it. Anyway, Oliver, what do you make of that?
I think that what Prince Charles said is actually completely spot on, and yes, I'm sure that the banks actually realise that this is ultimately what needs to happen, and that in a sane world it would happen, and therefore they need to be part of it. Because finance is nothing if not adaptable.
So the banks aren't leading this, and Charles following along, no?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that what is actually leading it is, as I was saying before, this multifaceted crisis, large elements of which are the ecological crisis with the mass extinction of species, which are ultimately essential for human survival on this planet, and the climate crisis and an allied economic crises. These are the crises that we face. But I think what we should look at is what has really happened since. What we needed was really an unprecedented global alliance to actually tackle these problems. And that would mean a coming together of all of the world's major powers, in a broader alliance with pretty much, well, ideally, every country in this world realizing that these are the most important issues that humanity needs to tackle in order to ensure global survival. So, what actually happened? Well, I can tell you what happened. What happened was the war in Ukraine. And so, just at this time, when it was most essential that we should be globally cooperating on tackling climate change, on tackling biodiversity loss, and on maintaining these fundamental elements like forests and the seas, of the Earth's climate system, which largely self-regulates itself in a very good way for making this habitable Earth that we live on, and realizing that by attacking core essential parts of that system, we are deeply endangering our own survival and that of every species on this planet.
What happened was
the Ukraine war dividing the world and making any such cooperation completely impossible.
Well, I understand that, but Charles was the first person, certainly probably as I know, when he was Prince Charles, coming out and saying Putin is the new Hitler. He hasn't really helped here, has he?
Well, he may not have helped. He probably isn't very well informed on this, in the same way as most people are not very well informed.
But what else isn't he well informed on then?
Well, I think he is pretty well informed on environmental issues, you know, but I mean, I don't expect him to be right about everything. And of course, the royal family is also close in a sort of close-knit alliance with the British military. Charles and pretty much every member of the royal family serves in the military. It is part of what confers legitimacy to the military system. But if you ask me, does Charles think it is a good idea to be provoking a third world war, he will say no. There are very few people who think that the deliberate provocation of a third world war is a good idea. And I actually think that this whole provocation of war is part of what preserves the imperial system.
Yeah. Because it's trying to preserve itself.
Yeah,
well, it's a bit of a desperate measure.
Because what it does, there are all of these issues that they don't like, and I think the environment is an issue that they don't like. Because the imperial system essentially derives its wealth and power from the deliberate, systematic destruction of nature. And that is both for direct commercial gain, but also the deliberate destruction of nature-dependent livelihoods among small farmers and so on across the world, who actually feed most of the world's people. They want to destroy that, so that instead those people who were previously feeding themselves depend upon an economic system dominated by major food companies, the likes of Monsanto and Cargill, for their food. So that destruction is a deliberate aspect of imperial policy, and so destroying the climate system and creating food scarcity, which is one effect of this Ukraine war, has been to create a deliberate food scarcity and a deliberate energy scarcity. This feeds massively into corporate profits, and you look at the dividends that oil companies have been declaring, most recently Shell and BP, higher even than market expectations. So this is what corporations are fundamentally interested in, is this generation of massive surplus profits.
Well, they are in charge, it seems. I mean, if, you know, we've got MPs on the back foot, or even starting to realise that which side their bread is buttered is not the voters' side, it's on the people who are paying the party into the party coffers on their side instead. I'm trying to come to a little bit of a conclusion here before our break. And so I'd like to do that by discussing the Bilderberg conferences a bit, which we're going to be at next week in Lisbon. These people are a bunch of politicians, bankers, royalty, many people from the tech industries, nowadays social media companies, a whole range, really. But it really does seem the finance people, the Goldman Sachs, the JP Morgans, people like that, are in the driving seat in policy, many of these. I'd like to just play a clip from a guy called Peter Manning. And my book is really looking at the origins of the Bilderbergers, the links to the Nazis in the Second World War, the fact that the conferences were chaired by a former SS officer for the first 20 years from 1954 to 1975. That's Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was also involved in this battle to liberate his country, even though he was a former officer of the SS. He'd married into the Dutch royal family and was mixing in circles in London and Washington amongst the Allies. Certainly, you know, appears to have been a spy. It sent in a guy to basically tell the Abwehr that the Battle of Market Garden was going to happen. And it was in that same area, the city of Arnhem in Holland, in 54, 10 years after the horrific Battle of Arnhem, where thousands of British paratroopers were killed, surrounded, because the Germans seemed to know they were coming. And then, after that, this chap, Martin Bormann, who was, at the end of the war, we're talking really here about the last months of the war, the last months of 1944 and 45. My book is called The Traitors of Arnhem. What he's done is done deals with the British, specifically Desmond Morton, who was Winston Churchill's private secretary, quite nicely. He himself was Adolf Hitler's private secretary. So deals were being done at the end of the war. And as Peter Manning here, he's the son of Paul Manning, who's a Canadian journalist during World War II for the CBS network, wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, because after the war, he decided that this was one of the most important stories of the war, that Bormann had indeed survived the war and was operating a Fourth Reich, a financial Fourth Reich, based in Latin America. So here is Peter Manning now talking about his father's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile.
He didn't realize how big the story was. He was just a journalist. He found a few things out at the end of the war. You know, what happened to Martin Bormann was one of the stories he was chasing down. And he thought some Nazis got away and took money with them, ran off to South America, and he chased down this story. Then he came back to the U.S., had a career, and he stumbled back into this story in the 1960s. I know he was 100% of his time was put into this in the late 60s and going into the early 70s. This was sort of a six-day-a-week project. He went to Europe a few times talking. What he wanted to do is actually interview Martin Bormann. So he was in contact with the Martin Bormann people in Europe and down in South America. And actually in 1972 or 73, I'm not sure when, there was a very elaborate plan that three photographers from CBS would go down to South America with my father, and he would interview Martin Bormann live, and it would be the anchor up in New York would be Walter Cronkite. That plan fell through, and the reason given is that the younger people in the Bormann organization did not want to rock the boat or make themselves known, whereas the older members wanted to proudly tell their history of how they helped an emerging new West Germany, and how they also helped to fight communism.
Peter, you say your father did not know the full implications of the story when he began, but he did. The impression that I get from speaking to you as well as from reading the book is that he did indeed understand that great, albeit unpalatable truth to many, which is that the Reich did survive and went in an underground fashion.
Yeah, definitely. It's a worldwide organization, but it looked to be purely commercial. What you say about a Fourth Reich coming around, I've been thinking about this for years, and yeah, I agree. I think it's not just commercial, it's philosophical, and they do want to emerge sometime in the near future.
So that's Peter Manning there, the son of Paul Manning, the author of Martin Bormann, Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The two books on this really are Op JB by Christopher Crichton, a.k.a. Christopher Crichton. Anyway, his real name, John Ainsworth Davis, who talks about the British abduction of Martin Bormann from Berlin through the canals into the hands of Desmond Morton in the British zone right at the very end of the Second World War. And we'll be hearing actually the Victory Day. This is the British dealing with the Nazis just as the Russians are having a victory over the Nazis in Berlin. The reason I'm talking about this is because of the quite clear and obvious links between the current Bilderberg conferences and the military action against the Russians and the Nord Stream pipeline, the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline. Amazing, really, that the Germans haven't made more of a fuss about this. Obviously, they're in on it, and they're somehow agreeing, the German leaders. I think if the German people knew, they would be absolutely livid. But let's have a listen now to an interview, a part of an interview I did earlier this year with Charlie Skelton. I'll be meeting up with over in Lisbon next week. as he pulls apart the links between the Nord Stream pipeline and the Bilderberg conference, which took place in Washington in 2022, specifically these various individuals, Jake Sullivan from the National Security Council in the United States, William Burns, the boss of the CIA, and James Baker, the head of this thing called the Office for Net Assessments, which funnels the money into these kinds of black operations.
Bilderberg locks in completely to the kind of Western war machine. And, you know, if you wanted to, you know, give a moral critique of Bilderberg, you could start there usefully. And if you look at the Washington summit, which was in last year, the 2nd to the 5th of June, there's that that Nord Stream article by Cy Hirsch has come out, saying that the mines that blew up the pipelines were laid in under cover of a Baltic Sea NATO operation, which began on the 5th of June, which was the last day of Bilderberg. And at that Bilderberg, if you look at who's there, it's pretty much everyone who would sign off on that operation. And I now realize that by saying this, I'm now straying into just arrant speculation, but except to say that, you know, you've got at that meeting, which you know, was literally the day of the days just before this NATO exercise began, at which the Nord Stream mines were laid, you had like the head director of the CIA, William Burns, was there. You had Jake Sullivan, who's the director of the National Security Council, and Cy Hirsch says ran the whole Nord Stream blowing up operation. You've got the director of the Office of Net Assessment from the US, a guy called James Baker, who he's like the top US war strategist, kind of actuary strategist, who says what operations are going to cost and which go ahead and don't, and you know, all of that. And you've also got the Ukrainian ambassador to the US and the CEO of Ukraine's biggest natural gas company, Naftogaz. And so if you were to say who are the people that might conceivably have an interest in this operation, they're pretty much all sitting there at the Mandarin Oriental in Washington, clinking champagne glasses and going, yeah, let's do it.
So that's Charlie Skelton, a freelance journalist who used to write for The Guardian quite regularly at the Bilderberg until Kath Viner took over as editor, Oliver. What do you make of this organisation as someone who, you know, obviously I've studied it quite closely, but, you know, the links to the Nazis, the chairman, the origin of it in the city of Arnhem, where the Nazis scored this incredible victory over the British and the Americans in the Second World War, which actually extended the end of the war, enough time for them to get their wealth into the parts of the world that they wanted it, Switzerland and South America, things like that. So it certainly looks as if this is, I mean, it's kind of like a gang, really.
Well, my own supposition on this is that there are two sides to these Bilderberg conferences. And there is the public conference. When I say public, of course, not just any old member of the public, but there are journalists there.
They don't write about it.
There is a sort of relatively public face. There are formal talks, there are meetings, there are workshops, and probably you could go to the Bilderberg conference and you could attend a whole lot of these open sessions.
Yeah, invite only. I mean,
it's invite only. But I think that you could go there and you could attend all these public sessions and that you would know nothing about this kind of thing that you are talking about. But as with all such meetings, as with every conference, it is not just about the conference speeches that are given from a podium or the discussions in workshops. There are private meetings, and it is in these private meetings that these serious discussions take place and serious decisions are made. And these are com- completely closed, they are completely secret, and no one outside of that small circle even knows that these meetings are taking place.
So what about my assertion that this is a sort of Fourth Reich going on here? The connections
to
the Nazis?
Well, there clearly is a Fourth Reich going on. And the values that are being perpetuated through the global economic system and through this system of empire, which we've been speaking of, it is, in its essentials, it is about there being a superclass of person that has wealth and power and who somehow has the right to control this planet for the benefit of themselves and these kind of surrounding clique of people who are loyal to that system. And then there is the great majority of us to whom things are done and who find that they have pretty much no choice through their political systems of what policies are carried out, and who simply have to suffer the consequences. And these values, which we see expressed through the global economic, financial, political, media system, are essentially those of Nazism. However, it does not show its face. I mean, one thing you can say for Adolf Hitler, he was not in any way squeamish about setting out what his purposes were, what his agenda was, what he was trying to bring about. But I think that very similar plans and intentions are being carried out, but instead of being set out for public view and criticism and debate and analysis and the possibility of voting for it or voting against it, it is being carried out in secret.
Yeah. Martin, what do you make of the Bilderbergers before we go to the break in a nutshell? What do you think they're all about?
Well, as Webster Tarpley from the US said a long time ago, the Bilderberg meetings don't decide things. It's where the junior officers are assembled to be told what the plan is. And a lot of the focus on the meetings themselves, the network of those meetings is important, obviously. And of course, and people who are excluded. So for years ago, Tony, if you remember, you were phoned up by the Prime Minister of Malawi's office to say, could he get an invitation to Bilderberg?
Yeah, he wanted to join.
Because Tony's interested in it.
I broke it to him that I'm afraid it's actually really only the NATO countries that are ever going to get invited to there.
That's
because
right.
That's its part of NATO, effectively.
And of course, at one stage, they pretended that they didn't exist. So I remember that Tony Blair denying that he'd been to Bilderberg because Bilderberg didn't exist and it was a conspiracy theory to suggest that it existed, which is mind-boggling think about it.
Then I met the woman who served in breakfast there.
Yeah, but the point about this is because it was held in secret for many years, you've then got a kind of coterie of people following it, the sort of alternative people following it, and they see that the meeting itself as the problem. But as Tarpley pointed out, the meetings, they gather together the junior officers and they've already decided what they're going to do. It's just telling them what's going to happen. They don't decide things at this meeting. But of course, they do have other meetings where things are decided, which we don't know about.
Okay, let's speculate. Given that Cy Hirsch and Charlie Skelton have put together absolutely irrefutable connections between this and Nord Stream, Martin, what might they be cooking up this year?
Well, I think it's extraordinary if we can just focus on the Nord Stream issue for a minute, because I was at a kind of fairly sort of progressive style party rave thing on Coronation Saturday, and I asked this guy who I know quite well if he'd heard about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline being blown up by the Americans. It was like, was there a pipeline blown up? I mean, that's how the level of most people don't even know the pipeline was blown up. Never mind worry about who did it. And that's because the mass media doesn't just function in terms of just misleading people about, you know, current affairs. There's also an awful lot of distraction.
Well, I'm saying,
the Eurovision Song Contest tomorrow night is a political event, but it's also just an enormous distraction.
Quite clearly, the purpose of these Bilderberg conferences and the networks around them is to exacerbate military differences and problems between NATO and Russia, specifically other, maybe with China too, but that is their main focus. I noticed last year, for example, they put Ukraine at the very bottom of their agenda, when you know, of course, it's actually right at the top. What do you think they might be cooking up this year?
Well, I think they're in crisis management mode, because what happened...
I mean, surely they are actually making the initiative. They're taking the initiative.
They are, in one way. But the blowing up of the pipeline was... And of course, the sanctions on Russia were supposed to be decisive. They've basically tricked... The Russians had to intervene in Ukraine from their own point of view. They tried everything else. The people in the East Ukraine voted to leave the Ukraine in 2014, just like the Americans had a Congress in 1776, said we don't be part of the British Empire anymore. Just like that. Just like the Sinn Féin won the 1918 election in Ireland and said, we're going for independence. So in many ways, and I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia, as you know, in the 90s, and this is exactly the kind of process that went through. It was not always orderly. It wasn't always, people didn't follow procedure. Let's put it that way. So... some things have worked for them and some things haven't. The fact that the German economy is now going to be deindustrialized is to the benefit of certain sections of the US capital. Yeah, so they move.
So what are the Bilderbergs going
to
do?
Well, I'm just trying to say that what's going to happen. You asked me to predict, and I'm trying to predict. Some things have gone well for them. They're quite happy to see the German economy go down. Yeah. They've not wanted Nord Stream 2 all along. The Americans and the British have said, no, you're not to do that. Whereas the Germans quite sensibly said, well, look, this is a long-term thing. You know, we can develop relations. I mean, Willy Brandt, when he's with his Ostpolitik back in the 70s, we're trying to build a long-term relationship with the Russians so that we can work together. This is what the assassination of Herrhausen was all about, as you were talking about earlier. But that hasn't worked. So they're now trying to decide what to do. They need to get out of the Ukraine war because they're going to lose it.
Let me make my prediction.
And they're trying to find a way around it.
Let me make my prediction. There'll be some sort of provocation to actually make the war in Ukraine worse.
The problem for that, Tony, is that they can't make it worse. They can only go to nuclear. They can only go to nuclear, which is just disaster. You know, everybody will die, but they can't win conventionally. So they need to find a way out. And, of course, they've locked... They could have pressured the Ukrainians to negotiate, which, of course, they were ready to negotiate in March last year, and then Boris Johnson turned up and told them not to.
Well, we are going to be discussing more about Ukraine. We're going to be hearing from Putin's Victory Day speech after the break.
He took 100 pounds of clay, and then he said, hey, listen, I'm gonna fix this world today, because I know what's missing. Then he rolled his big sleeves up, and a brand new world began. He created a woman and a lots of loving for a man. Whoa, yes he did. With just 100 pounds of clay, he made my life worth living, and I will thank him every day for every kiss you're giving, and I'll thank him every night for the arms that are holding me tight. And he did it all with just 100 pounds of clay. Yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did. Now can't you just see him walking around and round, picking the clay up off the ground, doing just what he should do to make a living dream like you. He rolled his big sleeves up
He created a woman and lots of loving for a man. Whoa, yes he did, with just 100 pounds of clay.
Power belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys the nickels worth. Bang, going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
Right! I am certain our cause is just, but gallon of gas. And I am certain our cause is moral, loss of life. And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Lying.
Again.
From the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity.
Again.
Demonstrations of this kind are demoralizing the whole country.
Corruption. Again.
Don't hate the media. Become the media.
It's up to you. Choice. It's up to you. Change the world. It's up to you.
Please do your part.
What the truth is.
Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you feel?
Bum, you get a job.
It's up to you.
What's
the right thing.
group of kids we've sent out into the world.
They certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.
Okay, so looking at the various things that we had there, we started off with 100 Pounds of Clay, Gene McDaniels, from the year before I was born, 1961, and Steinsky, It's Up to You, 1991, another 30 years on. And then just the year after that, America Number One from the band Consolidated. In fact, I think that was the Peel session. So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho on in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk, streaming live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, please, though. Not Google. Tonight, we're coming from Badminton in Gloucestershire, an outside broadcast with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, with the former editor of the Ecologist magazine, Oliver Tickell, and just bowled up is the former mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Everyone is in here tonight. George, lovely to see you. Could you just tell us a little bit about, we've been discussing over the last few weeks a tremendous amount of development going on, high-rise buildings in the city, and we seem to be losing a lot of our green space in Bristol. Now, my conclusion, and I may be wrong, you can correct me if I am, is that we've got an administration that doesn't really do anything except try to help these big developers to get what they want, actually, to a certain extent, even circumventing the statutory planning rules that there are out there. And as the Mayor Marvin Rees has only got another year to go, the whole system is going to be changing this time next year. He's trying to get as many plans through these high-rises before he's out.
Well, I think, to be kind, I would say that he wants to get housing built. But the danger is that that's at the expense of the quality of the city. And yes, of course we have to get houses built, and it's vital that we get social housing built. But I started the process of getting council houses built in Bristol, but there is a disincentive to do that because of the right to buy. And the right to buy, which has been supported by most of the political parties, and certainly the two main political parties, which means that you build social housing and then it gets taken away from you. And Bristol has lost about 15,000 of its social housing stock as a result of the right to buy. So, yes, there's a vital need to build back, and there's a vital need to find a way of making sure that we house everybody. And, you know, it's desperate. It's not just desperate in Bristol. It's desperate in every city in the UK, and particularly in the southern cities, where so many people are sleeping out. And I was in Oxford Street the other day, and there were just lines. This is on the eve of the coronation. There were just lines of people sleeping out. So I just want to make sure you understand that I absolutely understand the need to build more houses. But the trouble is, if you then just think in numbers and you don't think in terms of community and quality of place, you destroy everything that we treasure.
Well, a lot of this, George, though, is not even affordable housing. It's actually way out of most people's price range.
No, 90% of it's not affordable. And what's called affordable is not affordable. So, you know, only that is true social housing can you say is affordable. And so we've got a stupid system where we call, you know, we ask developers to build between 40 and 10% of affordable housing. It usually gets knocked back to 20 or zero. And that is generally 70 or 80% of market, which is way out of being affordable in a city like Bristol, which is the second least affordable city in the UK. So, you know, if you're poor in Bristol, I always say you're poorer than you are anywhere else, or you're certainly poorer. Yeah, Hull, the house prices are half what they are in Bristol. So if you're poor in Hull, you're much more likely to be able to afford to rent or to buy than if you're poor in Bristol.
Okay, Martin, I'd just like to bring you in, because actually this is we look around the world, we measure everything by things like GDP, and yet in Britain we've got such amazingly, I mean, basically every family has got incredibly high overheads. So you may be over in, I don't know, Vietnam or somewhere, we're being told, oh, they've got a very low standard of living, they only get this many dollars or pounds a week. But the fact is, here, our money that we're getting in wages, so much of it is going on this basic stuff that we need to live every day.
Well, I'm in private rented accommodation in Bristol, and it's a ridiculous price for what I've got there, and it's my rent's just been increased. I think I will be able to manage that, but of course lots of people won't be able to manage that going forward, and therefore homelessness is going to increase.
And there's been an announcement this week, 750,000 people in Britain now cannot pay their mortgage. So it's almost as if you can have the house, but it's not going to be yours, it's never going to be yours probably, and you have to be worried week after week as to whether you're going to be evicted or not.
Well, it's not just the people who are paying mortgages. I mean, my buy-to-let landlords, their costs are going up because mortgage rates are going up, so that's passed on to me as a rent increase. And people can't afford to rent in Bristol. You know, private renting, it's virtually impossible to get somebody to rent to you because the stock is quite low, and lots of people want to rent because they can't afford to buy, but they can't afford to do it. And of course, what happened in 2008, I was in private rented accommodation then, is that the buy-to-let landlord who owned about 100 properties around Bristol, he went bankrupt. And of course, everybody in those properties was then evicted because they had to be sold on to cover his debts. And that included me, although I managed to faint because I had a different legal situation than other people in my block. I was able to put that off for quite a while. But I think that, you know, people who cannot find, you know, housing is so fundamental to people's mental health and well-being. They can't, you know, relationships break down when housing goes. People can't start families and all this sort of thing. It has a tremendously deleterious effect on people.
George, we've also got the situation, as you know, up on the Downs, something like, well, between 70, 120, some say, some evenings, vehicles parking up there, caravans, people who are living in vans, travellers, because they simply have fallen out the bottom, really, of the housing market, and they have to have somewhere to live. Some people even sleeping in their cars up there now.
Yeah, and that's atrocious. And so we do need more housing. We can all agree about that. Then it's a matter of how do you do it. I don't think you do it by building on green space. You know, we need the lungs in the city. So that is vital. And yet building on meadowland, building on zoo gardens, building on parks, just on playing fields, to me is completely unacceptable. And so, the answer of the current mayor is to build high, and I think that's completely wrong. There's a misunderstanding. You can have high density without having high buildings, and some of the greatest places in our cities are quite high density, and some of the cities that we love to visit, you know, like Paris and Barcelona, are really high density, but they don't have a load of high buildings in the heart of the city. And so I think we just need to find the way of building these homes, but building them, creating streets, creating communities, creating spaces that people can enjoy. Otherwise, we're going to build a load of buildings that people won't want in the future. So it's simply not sustainable in the true sense.
No, it certainly doesn't seem to be.
Of the word.
And there are increasing numbers of people getting rather disgruntled.
I think what a great mistake that Marvin made. And, you know, I've got sympathy for him. You know, but he and I both had to face up to the same problems in the city. But he came in saying that, he never mentioned it before he was elected, but saying a city with ambition should build high. Well, we're not New York or Los Angeles or Las Vegas. We are Bristol, a wonderful historic city. People live there because they like it, and they come there because they like it. And yet we're at the moment going about the process of destroying its history and its skyline. So I think it's about green spaces, it's about skyline, it's about history, it's about community. And we can put all those things together and find really good solutions. And maybe we should be just a little bit less sacred about Green Belt, because there are parts of Green Belt where it would be possible to create villages that Relatively high density villages that could contribute to the situation.
What about these criticisms? And it may be criticism levelled at you too, George, when you were mayor. You're elected really to run the city. You're elected to make sure that the street lights are replaced when the bulbs go out. You're elected to empty the bins. And yet we see increasingly, don't we, mayors, particularly our present mayor, Marvin Rees, jetting off around the world as a sort of ambassador who is making decisions about all sorts of things, things to do with rewilding, making decisions about, and certainly campaigning for things like net zero. These are international issues, really. That, you know, surely you should make sure the bins are emptied, and you should make sure that the people in the city are housed before taking on those sorts of roles.
I think you've got to, you've got to do both things to a certain extent. Absolutely right. That what do people want? They want their bins emptied. They want the streets to be safe. They all those things. They want the parks to be looked after. They want their children to be educated. They want to be housed. All those things are absolutely vitally important. I think Bristol does have an opportunity, and it was something that I was really fortunate to be able to use when we became European Green Capital, of being a champion for environmental matters and making, trying to set an example of what a city should be like for a family to live in. You know, it should be a safe, the air should be as clean for a family living in the city as it is living in the country.
Well, hang on, but they've just approved another incinerator down upwind in Avonmouth. Well, actually, 2 years ago. But this is now on stream. It's chucking out the... apparently, there's a filter on it that stops all the plastic gases going into our air. I mean, that's not making things cleaner.
Well, there are lots of things not making things cleaner, and we've been really feeble about the clean air zone in the centre of the city. It's a pathetic token, really, and I don't think the air has become... may have gotten fractionally cleaner, but it's not... we're not getting clean air. If you... the poorest people in the city tend to live next to the radial routes coming into the city, and, living alongside the M32 or whatever it may be. That is where there's dirty air, and yet the clean air zone, which is the smallest of the options that were offered by the government, that was taken up by Bristol, is doing virtually zero in terms of making people's lives healthier.
Well, no, and apparently clean air levels were coming right down anyway because there's so many roads have been being closed off in the city. I mean, they're trying to turn it.
But some of those roads are involving, some of those closures are involving people making much longer journeys.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not about a cleaner air then, is it?
I mean, I was talking to an electrician the other day who has still got a diesel van, and he says he's having to drive twice as far around the city now in order to avoid the clean air zone in the centre, which actually made me think, well, maybe the whole of Bristol should be a clean air zone, and instead of having what is a rather token effort. I mean, go either do it or don't do it, at the moment we're half doing
it. I'm a Londoner originally, and I remember back in the 1980s when Ken Livingstone brought down the cost of public transport, which was in public ownership at the time, and lots of people just got rid of their cars.
Well, I think Ken Livingstone did a really good job on transport in London.
There was no stick, that was all carrot.
No, I think he did a really good job, and the first person I turned to when I got elected, surprisingly, and surprisingly to a lot of people, I went and had a cup of coffee with Ken at Westminster Underground. And it was really valuable because I said, how did you get this stuff through? He said, well, I just said I'd make it temporary, but I knew it was going to be permanent.
Oh, right.
And so I think that lesson was a really important one, is let's suck it and see.
They said that with the clean air zone.
Let's try things out and see if they work, and if they work, keep them.
They said with the clean air zone, it's going to be temporary, we're going to be taking it down. But there
Maybe that came from Ken.
Getting back to the sort of general state of affairs, particularly with housing, people cannot afford a house. Even if we do get thousands and thousands of new homes, but there are also tens of thousands of people in Bristol that won't be able to afford any of them, whether it's rent or buying. I mean, these are the people who are really at the bottom end of the income brackets. And we've also had this incredible thing with the boaters living in the city centre who are being told to pay up to 300% more this year, just as the council has passed a motion saying that there should be rent controls. They themselves have massively put the rents up like a rack-renting landlord on steroids. But we are facing increasing civil unrest potentially. I mean, we've got all sorts of protest movements, but also with the cost of living crisis being almost impossible now for many people to afford to pay the bills, and also with the increase in food banks, people are getting increasingly agitated. As a result, rather than trying to ameliorate those problems, the government has brought in some new something called the Police Bill and the Public Order Bill in order to curtail the rights of protest. So before we hear from George Monbiot, who's just done a piece about this, what do you, all three of you, maybe you could say something about the clampdown on the Republic demonstrators at last week's coronation. Maybe you first, Oliver. There was a really preemptive strike against them. So the Republic, who campaign against the monarchy, had been negotiating for weeks and weeks. In fact, I think one person I heard say 3 months with the police about what they were going to do and how it was all going to happen. And on the day, the police changed their mind and decided to arrest them.
Well, yes. Maybe that was their plan all along. I think there is nothing that one can possibly agree with about what they did. But it's interesting to think maybe why they did it. Did they want to put these people in jail? Did they want to prosecute them? I really don't think so.
No, I don't think any of them have been charged, have they? None of them have been charged.
Well, I think a few of them maybe, but it was really just about a preventative arrest, not because they were actually committing any crime. They just wanted them out of the way because they might spoil the spectacle.
That was PR. PR.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's wrong. I absolutely think it's wrong, but I think it's quite simple. They just didn't want them there.
George, what do you make of it?
I'm horrified by the Public Order Bill. It makes me want to go and protest. I mean, if anything will will make me go and protest is the government stopping me protesting. And it is a fundamental part of our democracy. That we can protest. We have a fake democracy anyway. I mean, we have a ridiculous electoral system. How has this government maintained power for so long? It's maintained power by fiddling the system, by having a electoral system that first past the post that favours them. If there was a sure way, and there was an article in The Guardian only a couple of days ago, if there's any one sure way of preventing this lot taking power again, it would be a form of proportional representation, because we don't have a majority of right-wing electors in this government, and yet somehow the combination of boundaries and the electoral system means we get the government we least want.
Okay.
And so protest.
And media.
And media, yeah, because the media is bought by all these powerful people who agree with the government.
Well, not talk radio, because you can phone up, as I do from time to time, and have a chat with them and say what you want at last. You know, that's actually quite an amazing thing.
We need mass protests now, and we need this law enacted in a way that people really realise what's happening.
Okay, well, look, we'll hear actually from George Monbiot. We'll let you give your comment after we've heard from him, Martin, about the new anti-protest legislation and what you think about the protests last Saturday at the coronations, the Republic demonstrators being arrested, even though they... I mean, what bothers me, the obvious thing is, why would anyone bother to negotiate with the police if they thought that they were going to be arrested anyway?
So the great power the police have been granted is to act, well, pretty well however they wish, to exercise extrajudicial authority in determining who may protest and who may not, who may speak out and who may not. I don't think they're going to come for me. I've got too high a public profile. I could make too much fuss. It's the people without that profile, without my privileges, who they will pick off. You could, if you are considered to be promoting protest, find yourself on the wrong side of the law. The right to protest and the right to free speech is very closely allied. And the government is blurring the distinction even further by effectively removing both rights with one bill. Already we've seen journalists arrested at environmental protests, even though the police knew they were journalists, but they wanted to shut down coverage. And if, well, they got sued and had to pay out a few £1,000 later, that didn't seem to bother them. I think increasingly we're going to find the police using their arbitrary powers to stop reporting protests as well as to stop the protests themselves. Always they'll tell you it's to prevent disorder, it's to prevent disruption. But what exactly do they mean by preventing disorder? Well, they mean exactly the same as coercive and controlling powers have meant for centuries. The Native Americans had to be corralled into reservations while European people seized their lands to prevent disorder. The Kikuyu people in Kenya had to be corralled into concentration camps and tortured to death there in the 1950s to prevent disorder. The Public Order Bill, as its name suggests, is introduced to prevent disorder. The anti-strike legislation is introduced to prevent disorder. What it shows us is that this disorder means a challenge to the coercive, illegitimate power which government seeks to wield over us. All the laws I'm talking about are police state legislation. They're the kind of laws you would expect to find in a totalitarian nation, or at least an extremely authoritarian one. You would think they had no place in a nation that claims to be a democracy. But democracy in this country has only ever been skin deep. It's a theatre of democracy, a pantomime of democracy. But it's not what democracy promises to be, which is control of political decisions by the people.
Well, obviously, I agree with what George said there and with what's been said by the other George and by Oliver. I think what's in, if you think about what's happened, the internal debates within the Conservative Party about who's going to run the country have taken over the politics of the country. So Priti Patel was leveraging herself towards making a bid to be prime minister. And that's one of the reasons why she brought this bill forward, because she presumed quite correctly that the 80,000 members of the Conservative Party, they like to see policemen dragging off demonstrators. That's the sort of thing they want to see. As far as they're concerned, that's the smack of firm government. And this is because you've got a tiny selectorate of the Conservative Party and the first-past-the-post system, which allows them to form a government of a majority of 80 on 43% of the vote.
It's not just Conservative members that like to see it, Martin, is it? It's also the big corporations, the fascists, in a way, hanging around in the background, waiting for democracy to fall to pieces so they can take over.
Well, I think we haven't mentioned this, but the bill that was passed already, that has already been passed, which gives the police, the military and the intelligence services complete... They cannot be prosecuted.
Impunity from the law.
I mean, why would you want to pass a law that gives your intelligence services complete impunity? It's absurd. Well, it's not absurd. It's very sinister. And I think we're going to go on to talk about the situation in Russia and Ukraine. But if you brought before the Russian Duma a bill to make these intelligence services be above the law, it would be laughed out of the building, because of the experiences they have had. They wouldn't allow that for a minute. But as in Britain, it's just presumed that, James Bond knows what he's doing and he should be able to have a license to kill.
I just think it's important that when we're looking at the destruction of democracy and the dismantling of democracy, we don't forget a certain Jeremy Corbyn and what happened to him. There's a film out last month. Actually, I think it may be in the end of March it was completed by the filmmaker Norman Thomas, which has been banned from this by the South West Trades Union Council from this year's Tollpuddle Festival. In fact, the people who were running the film programme for Tollpuddle Festival in July 2023, this is the annual festival. Do you want to just say a little bit about Tollpuddle, Martin? You probably know more about it than I do. It was about the origins of the trade union movement in Britain, isn't it?
Well, the Tollpiddle Martyrs, as they originally called it, was originally called Tollpiddle, And because of the fame that the village got as a result of the case against the farm labourers, all the propaganda, they called it Toll Puddle, because they didn't want to call it Toll Piddle. So there you are. That's just an interesting historical fact.
You definitely do, yeah. Okay.
But anyway, they were farm labourers who tried to form a trade union, and they were sentenced to transportation to Australia for swearing illegal oaths. Because, of course, they had to swear to support the union, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, eventually they were brought back because they were released and brought back to Britain because there was a huge campaign.
Well, what is that law? Because surely every Freemason should go to jail.
Well, indeed, it was only workers that weren't supposed to swear illegal oaths, and obviously okay. Bosses can do whatever they like. Anyway, they eventually came back. Robert Owen and the Grand National Consolidated Trade Union made a big campaign to release the Toll Puddle martyrs, as they were called, and they were brought back. There's quite a good film about all of this. It was made in the 80s called Comrades. It's quite a long film.
Okay.
But you can find it.
The film about Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Is a really excellent film.
Oh, you've seen it.
I've seen it, yeah.
Great.
And I don't know whether, you know, it's 100% correct, but we should all see it. And the idea that people are being prevented from seeing it is horrendous.
Yeah, the left.
It is part of, you know, this is a really important part of free speech.
Anyway, we're going
to have... It opened my eyes to what has happened and the way Jeremy Corbyn was the victim of an extraordinary conspiracy. And so, you know, I'm no Jeremy Corbyn fan, but I really do hate the fact that he was hounded by what was a big lie saying that he was anti-Semitic. And I've got Jewish heritage, but I don't believe that Jeremy Corbyn's anti-Semitic. I think this was a big construct.
Oh, I'll put a link to the trailer for The Big Lie. It's called, actually, the film is entitled Oh, Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie, 2023. Up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I spoke this week to Norman Thomas, who's the director of the film, and I asked him about Labour democracy, which he thinks is pretty much dead now under Starmer.
Democracy in the Labour Party is dead, in effect, and it's not just in Bristol, it's everywhere. Starmer is stamping it out. Starmer will be as right-wing, if not more right-wing, than any Tory Prime Minister we've got. I mean, people have to really face up to that. I mean, there was a long, long time people thought, oh, well, the Labour Party, you know, it may have a few faults, but it's better than the Tories. At the moment, Starmer is not really adhering to that idea at all. He's basically saying he's going to go with any repressive things that the Tories do, he will do better. And he's going to be worse. There is a myth that Starmer is pretending all this, that when he gets into power, he'll suddenly pull off his civilian clothes and become a socialist superman. That is rubbish. It's nonsense. Starmer, if anything, is going to be worse than what he's saying now, which is saying something. So it's really, really a very, very bad time for anyone who believes in democracy.
Well, we saw at the World Economic Forum him saying how much to Emily Maitlis at Newsnight, that how much he preferred the World Economic Forum to Westminster, which is a little bit concerning. Anyway, look, we've come here to talk about Corbyn. Can you just, without spoiling it too much for viewers, potential viewers, what's your film about?
It's about the rise and fall of the movement that almost got Jeremy Corbyn elected to number 10 in 2017. Because it's a phenomenal story in its own right. Regardless of your politics, this guy who's a complete and utter nobody in national political terms, you know, a protest politician, suddenly almost in 2017 goes from being the kind of the dead cert failure to becoming almost the prime minister. And then what the establishment does to him in terms of smearing, ludicrous smears in a way. I always think, you know, if they just called Jeremy Corbyn out for being, you know, a communist or a left winger or believing in unrealistic policies, well, fair enough, that's a right wing point of view. But to call him an anti-Semite when everybody who knew anything knew that that was a total lie, or most of his supporters. Very, very few examples in the Labour Party of real anti-Semitism, and yet they used it to smear him.
So I also asked Norman, that's Norman Thomas we're talking to, I spoke to earlier this week, actually this morning, about what exactly happened with Tollpuddle and how he found out that the film was going to be banned there.
The people who organised the festival have decided to make martyrs of the people who were trying to put on a screening of a film in their festival. It's so crazy and stupid that it's unbelievable, really. I mean, the film was due to be shown, the Jeremy Corbyn film was due to be shown there, and was booked to be shown there months ago, and then suddenly, and it's been shown in a shortened form, half-hour form, months before that, and it won an award. It won the People's Award, or the Audience Award for the festival in the year before. So now it was naturally the finished form was going to be shown in July at the festival. And the SWTUC said, no, you can't show this. They came up with lots of different reasons for why it couldn't be shown. One was they didn't like the title because the big lie being the subtitle. They thought that was to do with Hitler and that would cause upset. I mean, that was complete nonsense because there's been, you know, hundreds of films called The Big Lies, you know, since its origins back in 1930s Germany. They then said it would in some way cause disturbances at the festival. Where that comes from, how a film showing is going to cause disturbances, you know, is it going to frighten the horses? It's absolute nonsense. So they said it couldn't be shown for that reason. The people the very decent people who wanted to show the film or organize the actual film screening event said, well, if we can't show this film, we won't show the event at all. And so they pulled the whole event. And the TUC then, when asked about it, that is the National TUC, said this film was not going to be shown because it didn't uphold TUC values and it might affect the safety of staff and stewards.
Well, that's Norman Thomas, the director of Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie. George, because you've seen it, can you just give us a kind of précis what it's about?
Well, it's a very good analysis about the way that the influence of the Zionists and the Israeli government, which is very different from the Jewish people. I mean, I associate myself with the Jewish people. The Jewish people are not the problem. There's the Israeli government and the Zionists are determined to make anybody who criticises them as being anti-Semitic, which is so wrong. And because Jeremy Corbyn was critical and principally supportive of the Palestinians, we got this construct that therefore he is anti-Jew. He's not anti-Jew. And I've talked to Jeremy Corbyn, and I find Jeremy Corbyn, I disagree with an awful lot of him. I mean, I really don't align myself with a lot of Jeremy's politics, but I'd absolutely defend his right to attack the Israeli government and some of the Zionist movements who have penetrated a lot of our society. And so we have to be able to question this without being told we're monsters. And then I think it's about the more conventional part of the Labour Party, the old Labour Party, then using this as a way of ditching Corbyn. And so we have seen this happening right up to today. You know, some members of the Labour Party, I think, have been most unwise. Some have said stuff that you could say is anti-Semitic. But it's a minority, and it's not Jeremy Corbyn. And the film absolutely convinces me of this.
Okay, so Martin Summers, this is your party.
It is, and it breaks my heart that all of these things are going on, but I'm also not surprised. I mean, I've been around for quite a while. I've seen all of this happening before, not to the same extent, but the struggles between, you know, the more establishment-oriented parts of the Labour Party and the full-time officials and so on, and the trade unions can swing either way on that one.
Well, there's some very powerful forces out there that are cheering that the Labour Party now is so ineffective.
Well, it's not ineffective, Tony, because they're on course to become the largest party after the next election, and this, of course, is the justification.
Okay, so
for
if
all
they take over next year, are they going to be really fighting for ordinary people?
Well, I'm afraid,
or are they just going to be another version of the Tory Party?
Well, they are going to be another version of the Tory Party, as the Labour Party actually is. It's the alternative government, and of course Starmer's presenting himself to the red wall voters, who are the most important ones, as we all know, because they're the swing voters in the swing constituencies, that he's a safe pair of hands, and that we're, you know, all of this kind of infantile disorder of the Corbyn era is over. Corbyn is no longer even going to be allowed to stand as a Labour candidate, even in his constituency, which he's represented for 40 years.
Is Diane Abbott, amazingly. Oliver, what do you make of the, I don't know if you've seen the film, or of the Corbyn phenomenon and all these accusations of anti-Semitism?
Well, they were clearly ludicrous and untrue, and that was clear all along. And so it is simply yet another example of how our media routinely, systematically, purposefully lie to us. One thing I wonder is just how it's done. I mean, how is this actually organised? You know, and we see it again with reportage of Ukraine, that there is this highly systematic, organised effort to completely mislead us. And that it is largely successful. And following on from the George Monbiot interview, which you did, and where I largely agree with what he said, and I agree with all of these criticisms of the Conservative government that he makes and that other liberal commentators are making, well, they brought it upon us. Because which was the newspaper that was most decisive in attacking and undermining Jeremy Corbyn? It was Monbiot's newspaper. It was The Guardian. They were the ones that led this whole effort. Who, more than anybody else, is responsible for Julian Assange being in prison? The Guardian. Through themselves publishing the password to large amounts of the WikiLeaks archive, which actually Julian Assange was not releasing, but then blaming it on him successfully, even though they released the password. So who are the forces that have actually created this nightmare of a Conservative government and all of these things that the liberal commentariat and so-called left commentariat attack? It is actually the left themselves.
Amazing. And if you could look around the world to try and find a country where the people actually do support, genuinely support their leader, I'm afraid you've got to go to Russia. It's one of the only places, certainly in Europe, where you've got such mass support for leadership. And in fact,
Hungary.
It seems to have...
Hungary as well.
Hungary is like that too, okay. But anyway, so let's go to Victory.
But I'm going to part with you there in terms of them being honourable leaders.
Well, maybe, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, whether the people support them or not is up to them.
That's a different matter.
I think you've got here a great, enormous disillusion with the population in the various forms of leadership that we have managed to procure for the public. Anyway, so we're going to go to Moscow now, to Victory Day, to have a listen to Vladimir Putin speaking in Red Square. I found it quite difficult to get hold of, but the French did a very good version of this and an excellent translation. So here's Putin's, an extract anyway, from Putin's, translated, thank God, for Victory Day speech earlier this week in Red Square.
What we want for the future is a future of peace, a future of stability, not a future of blood. But the elite in the West, they keep talking of their exceptionalism, of how they are different, and they are the ones creating a sense of disruption between our peoples. They are the ones destroying family values, traditional values that make everyone on this planet human. They are forcing their will on other nations, forcing their rules on others. But it would appear that they have forgotten what Nazism was all about. It seems that they have forgotten the scourge that it wreaked. They have forgotten all that had to be done to free Europe from Nazism. Nazism, a time when monuments were destroyed. And they would appear to have forgotten exactly what Nazism did back in the day where they were wreaking havoc throughout Europe. And that very act of forgetting is a crime in its own right. Because in forgetting that time, they're forgetting the fight that was necessary to be able to rid Europe of that scourge, to rid Europe, the world, of that scourge. Nazism was an effort to destroy Russia, to destroy the global order, to stifle the new centers of development that we see around the world. Their impunity is a great tragedy. And that is the very reason why today the Ukrainian people are being held hostage. They're being held hostage following a coup. And they are just puppets in a game that is being played by the West.
So let's hear comments from our guests. First of you, Oliver, what do you make of Putin's, what he's saying there, I mean, particularly about saying that the Ukrainians are being held hostage in a game?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. It is that simple. I think that his analysis is broadly correct. And it is something that may seem rather extraordinary to many people in this country, that what he says is broadly correct. But that is because the media has so shaped the narrative around Russia for certainly the last 10 or 15 years, I think, when Russia was sort of turned into to an official enemy.
But, I mean, surely, they're not being held hostage in Ukraine. They are engaged in a fight for their own survival, and they're very brave of them to stand up to...
They are engaged in a fight for their own survival. But the enemy of Ukraine is actually not Russia at all. The enemy of Ukraine is the West, which deliberately created this war. They fomented this war. They organized and financed the coup that took out a democratically elected president and replaced it with a highly nationalist, fascistic government put in place by Victoria Nuland, Joe Biden, being people on the ground at the time, which actually draws its roots in going back more than 100 years into the fascist movement, which developed in Ukraine, very similar to the fascist movement in Germany, which was also taking root at that time, but which was actually even more extreme and ruthless, and which then ran Ukraine under the German occupation, and which sent millions.
Sounds to me like you want. Sounds to me like you want the Russians to. You want the Russians to win.
Well. If you look at the coup that took place in 2014 and put in place a government with that history And that ideology, which was explicitly Russophobic, and then you look at what did this government actually do once it was installed. The first thing it did was to ban the Russian language. This understandably caused a reaction. The people in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine knew exactly who these people were and what they believed in, and they saw what they were doing.
Okay,
and
so
they
said, is there a solution to it? Is there going to be a peace?
Well, peace will come eventually, but I just want to draw attention first to one particular aspect of this report, which is an incredibly well-kept secret. After that 2014 coup, there was almost immediate military repression of civilian protests of the anti-Maidan movement. We hear all about the Maidan movement, but there was an anti-Maidan movement in the East of the people who had almost all of them elected the president, Yushchenko, who was then deposed. And they thought, this isn't our government, this coup government in Kiev, this isn't our government. We elected our president. And if this is what you're going to do, we actually want... At that time, they weren't asking for independence. They were saying that they just wanted autonomy, to do their own thing in their own region, speak their own language, read their own books, perpetuate their own culture in peace. And those demonstrations were bombed. They were shot. People were burnt alive in Odessa. People were rounded up and imprisoned and tortured to death. That was the Ukrainian government response to this peaceful movement.
Well, they obviously saw it as seditious under this new government, despite there having been a coup. Anyway, let's let George give his view. This is
I clearly know a lot less of the history than Oliver, but... I have to say, I don't buy this narrative that Putin is on the side of good. I think Putin is a manipulator. He's a very clever manipulator. He has risen to power by being absolutely merciless within Russia. He has big ambitions for making Russia great again. He's a sort of antithesis, but got some similarities with Trump in terms of making America great again. I think that he's been absolutely ruthless, and he's been ruthless with the propaganda. So I don't expect us to buy his propaganda, but I know some... I know several Russians, and some absolutely hate him and some absolutely adore him. The ones that hate him have generally gone to Israel, ironically. I don't say that the Ukrainians are all good. I know a lot of the Ukrainians have come over here. I've talked to them. I don't get the impression that they are fascists or Nazis in any way. They may have some racial prejudices, but that is the way, you know, they've been brought up in rather a white nation, and it is clear that some of those prejudices do exist.
Yep, George,
and one doesn't make any apology for that.
What about prospects for peace, though? Because we've had Boris went over to scupper a peace deal that was being brokered. I think it was in April last year. And it certainly doesn't look now as if there is going to be any kind of...
We should all be working towards...
We're pouring weapons in, aren't we?
We should all be working towards a peaceful solution.
So would you ask Ukraine to stop shelling the civilian population of the Donbass with NATO-supplied artillery and American-supplied HIMARS missiles deliberately aimed
at the civilian
population?
Absolutely, both sides should stop aiming at the civilian population.
Because this is what they've been doing.
Yeah, but it's quite clear that the recent bombing of the cities, including Kyiv, were aimed at the civilian population.
Let's just get round to get people's opinions first.
I think neither are blameless in terms of that, but I think it's absolutely vital that we implore both sides to stop shelling the civilian population. It's so clearly recorded that there have been some terrible war crimes. And I, I'm not on the ground. How do I know? But it is absolutely certain that the Russians have committed some dreadful war crimes, and you cannot excuse that for any reason.
Martin, certainly for nationalist reasons, gaining more land. This is a war on European soil. It also has the potential to get bigger, doesn't it?
It does, because it's not just about Ukraine. It's about de-dollarization, this face-off between the Russians and the Chinese. It's a global, you know, the Ukrainians are, you know, suffering because they're, you know, other people have come to fund their fights in their territory. Similar to what happened in Yugoslavia. I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s, and you could certainly say that there was atrocities on all sides. Virtually everybody was doing nasty stuff.
But that's war, isn't it?
Well, it isn't war. I mean, it was because of the nature of the conflict. But of course, the Ukraine is not dissimilar. The Ukraine has only existed as a state since 1991. Yugoslavia existed in the state since 1919. So it was an unstable state anyway, which was only came to independence as a result of the breakup of the USSR, where in fact the majority of Ukrainians voted to keep the USSR. But the Kuchma, who took over, decided to do a deal with Yeltsin and the then leader of Belarus to break up the Soviet Union. Now, all of these things just add complication. But I think there's also a big gaps in the media here in the reporting of what happened in 2014. You mentioned Yushchenko. It was actually Yevtushenko who was removed. Yushchenko was the other guy, who was actually the pro-Western politician. And what was happening in Ukraine, and I used to have to study this because I was an East European desk officer for CAFOD and so on, the left and the pro-Ukrainian and the pro-Russian, they kind of alternated in power. And when Kuchma was in power in the 90s, they realised that they've got to keep some, you know, whoever's won has got to keep the other side on side. That it was inherently unstable. In the Maidan protests in 2014, there was a sniper attack on the protesters and the police. Ultimately, the Berkut riot police were put on trial in Kyiv, as they now like to call it, for supposedly shooting the protesters, even though their own officers had also been shot by the snipers. It came out in that trial in 2017 that, we know this because two of the snipers actually testified on video from Georgia about they were the ones who actually carried out the shooting. 50 snipers were involved, 48 from Ukraine, 2 from Lithuania, under the command of a US officer named Boyengar, B-O-Y-E-N-G-A-R. Probably not his real name, but plenty enough for Interpol to be getting on with in terms of finding out who actually did it. Ultimately, the court in Kyiv exonerated the Berkut riot police. They left court without a stain on their names. It clearly wasn't them that had done it. And I was on RT at the time when it happened, and I said, well, this is really good news, because it shows that the courts in Kyiv are independent, despite everything that's happened. And by that stage, thousands of people were already dead. But, of course, this hasn't been reported in the West. It should have been all over the Western media that the snipers at the beginning that killed all those people were organised by a US officer.
Yeah, okay, so that's how...
In other words, NATO intelligence.
Most people understand, Martin, that is how coups work. Oliver, I'll just let you have a final word on this. Someone sort of a little bit in between these two. Martin, sort of very extremely pro and George anti-Putin. What do you think are the genuine prospects for peace?
I'm not pro-Putin, Tony.
Or else escalation?
Well, one of the main things that got Russia into this war after, let us remember, 8 years of trying to have the Minsk II Accord implemented, which Ukraine signed up to, Petro Poroshenko put his signature on it, but it was never implemented, which would basically bring peace to eastern Ukraine by granting autonomy to that region and by bringing an end to hostilities. That never happened, and it turns out that Poroshenko had no intention of ever doing it. When Zelensky got elected, he was elected on the basis of a promise to his country of bringing peace and of implementing those accords. What actually happened was, once he was elected, the far-right movement, Azov Battalion, right sector, et al., told him, you're not going to do this, because if you do, we will hang you from a tree. And it never happened. Instead, the war against the civilian population of the Donbass, which had been going on since 2014, Zelensky continued to arm the country with a view to not only perpetuating that war, but to increase its scope and intensity. Now, can we go back to the Minsk II Accords as a way of bringing peace? I think it's way too late now. Why should Putin believe a word that the West says? France and Germany were the guarantors of that agreement. They did nothing, absolutely nothing, to see it implemented.
Well, it sounds to me,
Angela Merkel said that she never intended to. She's one of the signatories.
Sounds to me like you're saying a wider war is inevitable. I mean, we had Mark Sloboda on this programme, who's an American ex-official. Well, I mean, he was an officer in the nuclear force, and now he teaches in Moscow State University, saying he thought that this war would never end.
Well, let's have a look at what this war is for. And I think there are actually three purposes. One purpose is to inflict a defeat on Russia. That certainly doesn't look like happening anytime soon. Another purpose was to divide Europe from Russia so that the natural synergy on this one Eurasian continent between Europe, with its industrial and financial power, and Russia, with its wealth of natural resources and, in fact, other many, very many considerable skills, to force a divide so that that natural alliance would be broken forever. And there, this war has fully succeeded. That break between Russia and Europe has taken place, and it's hard to see that being reversed. And then a third plan is actually the subjugation of Europe. And this is exactly what we see, is the economic and financial and industrial subjugation of Europe to the imperial will in Washington. Two out of three aims have been achieved. And then there is another huge impact, which is actually against what America wanted, which is that in dividing Russia from Europe, it has actually created a much wider global alliance with Russia, China, and huge parts of the developing world, I mean, in Asia and Africa and South America.
It's pretty shocking, the effect that it's had on dividing the world, actually. It's incredible to think that something like that can happen. Anyway, it's good to announce today that Imran Khan has been, his release has been ordered by the Pakistani courts. Glad to hear that, after this kind of arbitrary arrest by soldiers, and which is in a situation which could potentially have precipitated rather quickly a kind of civil war in Pakistan. So he's now been arrested. Apparently it was wrongful arrest earlier this week. But I'm going to leave the final word this week to a woman called Olya. She has family on both sides of the Ukraine war in the Donbass, and she came along to an event called Let's Talk About the War, organised by the Stroud Freedom Group a few weeks ago. So the final word on this tonight's show, and then we can all shuffle off and get a bit of supper, is Olya's.
In the Soviet Union, there was a mixture of nations, and our blood is so interlinked, so it's almost impossible to separate it now and take Ukrainian blood, Russian blood out from our bodies. My mother, she spent part of her life in Donbass when she was young, studying in a school in Donbass. And when the war started in Donbass, we were greatly involved in it, because this is where her schoolmates were.
Was that in 2014?
Yes. Yes. This is where her schoolmates were, with whom she studied when she was a young girl. So what was the options for them? Some of the people from Donbass, they made a choice to come to Russia, and my family, was looking after some of them, trying to find a safe place for them to be. They came to Poland with nothing because their homes were invaded in Donbass. Part of people decided to stay and fight in Donbass. Majority of my mom's mates stayed there, fighting for the freedom of Donbass. Some are in Russia now, alive. But a lot of who stayed, yeah, they're all dead. But they said, we will stay there. We will fight for our land in Donbass. And one by one, my mom was receiving information how her schoolmates were dying. I'm trying to stay away from the politics, but my first education degree is in politics, in fact, in government and state administration. So I know a little bit of the politics from studying for 6 years in the university. What is happening now is the people who understand the fruitless of war, we know that how many people are dead already. I've chosen to stay away, deep in the village, away from the central system and what is governing all the swords. But now, men from Russia, young boys, the all they're fighting war for, you know, one by one, we've seen news about the deaths of our boys on both borders, Ukrainian and Russian. I don't define Ukrainian and Russians because I cannot. It's impossible. And this war, which brought up not by people, and then casualties and death on each side, and it's a tragedy for both Ukraine and Russia.
So that's Olya, a Russian woman, speaking in Stroud a few weeks ago, explaining how both sides of her family, on both sides of that conflict, and how many of her mother's friends have died since 2014, fighting for the freedom of the Donbass, that region in the south east of Ukraine. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, former Mayor of Bristol George Ferguson, and also former editor of the Ecologist magazine Oliver Tickell here. Also, of course, to long-suffering sound engineer Dave Bazanko, struggling with our microphones this evening. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also be able to find the podcast, full-length interviews from tonight, quite a few, and story links and comment page and our email addresses if you want to send in a story. The website is thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, talkradio.org.uk, and the app from the Fourth Reich secret NATO government in Lisbon, Portugal, at 5 o'clock UK time next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Thank you.